Part 1. Expedition. Luke Skywalker scrambled up the rocky slope, his lungs burning with each heavy breath he took. He was relieved to hear his nephew beside him also panting for breath, because that meant his own difficulties with the climb were in no way a reflection of his age or fitness. It was simply that the atmosphere on Mon Lali Maffear was thin, that was all. Behind them came the terrible baying of the Krizlaws. The sound was high-pitched and piercing, even through the rarefied atmosphere, and sent a shiver down his spine. With their great rancor-like heads bent low, sniffing for a scent, Luke knew that the smooth and pink-skinned aliens wouldn't be too far behind, converging from around the ruined palace to join in the hunt for the landing party. He glanced over his shoulder, half expecting to see them snapping at his heels already. Thankfully, though, they weren't that close. But even as he looked, he saw seven of them emerge from a decorative archway at the base of the nearest wall, tripping over one another and slipping on the rubble in their haste as they headed for the ceremonial mound. Another three jump-rolled from a window, scurrying out of sight behind a statue. Small reddish eyes, two thin arms tipped with three poisoned claws, two powerful legs designed for pouncing, mouths with jaws extendable enough to swallow a human head in one gulp. The thought was a reminder for Luke that he should keep moving. "Only 10 of them," Dr. Soren Haggerty said, the surprise evident beneath her own panting. She seemed to be finding the pace more difficult than the others, barely keeping up, even with Jason's help.
"There have always been 11. I thought that might have been significant."
A second later, another Krizlaw leapt through the window, shattering what little remained of the already splintered ornate frame, then dashed for the mound also. The xenobiologist shook her head, as if to suggest she was tired of being right all the time.
11, she confirmed.
"Come on, Dr. Haggerty," Jason said. Luke felt his young nephew subtly augmenting her stamina with the force. "We have to keep moving." "Ritual hunting party, you think?" Lieutenant Stalgis asked. The stocky Imperial in light combat armor turned to snap a shot back at the seven coming up the mound. The blaster bolt took one on the shoulder, provoking an ear-splitting squeal of pain, but didn't slow the creature down.
"Something like that?" Haggerty gasped.
Luke and Jason exchanged worried looks. The xenobiologist was tiring fast, and the top of the mound was still some distance away. The structure consisted of soil packed tight around a central core of stone, creating a tall, conical pseudo-pyramid with a truncated stone summit, perfect for an impromptu landing field. The shuttle was waiting for them there, engines warmed up and ready to whisk them off to safety. The only problem was that at this rate, with the doctor's endurance flagging, they weren't going to make it. The two Jedi turned simultaneously to see the Krizlaws making their way up the slope in assured and steady bounds, digging in with their claws and using their enormous thigh muscles to propel them forward. Seeing Luke and Jason making a stand, the creatures hurried their ascent, their howls intensifying with each leap. Luke had seen the effects these ululations could have on lower life forms when he'd witnessed the Krizlaws feeding. The intense vibrations of their howls stunned nerve centers, disoriented senses, and sent muscles into spasm. While their prey was thus incapacitated, the Krizlaws would eat them whole. Dr. Haggerty had said that the Krizlaws believed the still-beating heart to be essential for good digestion. "You won't be digesting this Jedi," Luke swore determinedly, "whole or otherwise." He sent his senses deep under the surface of the mound. Packed it might be, but the soil wasn't bound like ferrocrete. There were fissures underneath the surface, numerous pressure points that, with one solid nudge, could be there. Signaling Jason, he mentally linked up with his nephew using the force-meld technique perfected in recent months. Together, their minds pushed at the pressure point he had found beneath the surface. Dirt erupted from the slope below as though a buried machine had suddenly come to life.
The shower of dirt hid the shifting forces beneath, as disturbed ground found itself falling, gathered momentum, disturbed more in turn, and became an avalanche that swept over the Krizlaws, driving them back down to the base of the mound. Stalgis cocked an eyebrow. "Impressive," he said approvingly, and with obvious relief. Slinging his blaster rifle over his shoulder, he headed back up the mound at a more leisurely pace. "We're not out of this yet," Jason said. Luke silently agreed. Urging himself forward, he activated his comlink. "We're on our way," he reported. "Any sign of disturbances?" The pilot of the Imperial shuttle didn't waste any words. "All clear. We're ready for liftoff." Above them, he could hear the whine of engines. Relieved that they would soon be off-planet, Luke allowed himself a moment to puzzle at what had gone wrong. Everything had gone so well at first. Munlali Mafir was a planet that Hegarty had listed as one whose indigenous population told of a migratory world that had once appeared in their system, stayed briefly, and then vanished. It wasn't necessarily Zonama Seacoat, but everyone agreed that the lead was worth following up. Upon arrival, however, it had been apparent that something had changed. The Jostran natives of Munlali Mafir were, according to Hegarty's records, slow-moving centipedes barely larger than a human arm. What they'd found, though, was a colony of Krizlaws, listed as feral herd beasts with no more intelligence than a common nerf, and no sign of the Jostrans at all. Something appeared to have elevated the Krizlaws to full intelligence, while at the same time wiping out the Jostrans. Either that or the Imperial probe records had simply been wrong. The language used by the Krizlaws was, in fact, the same as that recorded in Hegarty's files, except that it was attributed to the Jostrans. The Krizlaws were not a starfaring species, so the arrival of the Imperial shuttle had prompted an enthusiastic welcome. Luke, Jason, Hegarty, and a small honor guard of stormtroopers had been invited to a ceremonial banquet, at which the visitors had witnessed the grisly eating habits of the planet's indigenous inhabitants. The local chief, who looked indistinguishable from the others except for a brightly colored belt wrapped around his smooth midriff, had freely passed on the legend about the star world that had appeared in the sky 4 decades earlier. Lacking telescopes or other optical instruments, their observations had been somewhat limited, but it seemed that this star world had appeared as a blue-green light in the skies of Munlali Mafir. It had stayed there for almost 3 of the planet's months. Then, as mysteriously as it had appeared, it disappeared again. For the time that this star world held its place in the sky, Munlali Mafir had undergone a period of increased seismic activity. Numerous volcanoes around the planet erupted, and the lands making up the 3 continents had been rent by groundquakes, all of which resulted in the deaths of many of the natives. Although the locals at the time, whether Jostrans or Krizlaws, Luke had been unable to determine, had no geologic knowledge to speak of, or indeed any understanding of the gravitational effects that astral bodies could have upon each other, they had, nonetheless, associated the spate of disasters with the arrival of the new planet. To them, the star world was a harbinger of death and upheaval, and Luke made every effort to reassure the chief, and his people, that it was unlikely the star world would ever return. It was then that the trouble had started. A hush had descended on the gathering as Luke patiently explained that the visitation of the rogue planet had been nothing more than a chance event, and it was doubtful that such an occurrence would be repeated. He assumed that Zonama Seacoat was simply looking for somewhere safe to hide, and had moved on once it had become clear that Munlali Mafir was inhabited. It was very possible, he had assured the chief, that the star world was in fact by now on the other side of the unknown regions. He explained that the terrible consequences of its visit, the ruin of most of the planet's stone cities, the disruption to ocean currents, and the impact upon some vital environmental resources, such as aquifers, were only temporary. These things, he promised, would soon return to normal. Instead of being relieved by his reassurances, though, the locals had become agitated. The chief had signaled his guards, and the visitors, esteemed guests just moments earlier, had suddenly found themselves treated as captives. Luke had forbidden any form of resistance from his party, confident that he could talk their way out of a violent confrontation. It was only as he had tried to make contact with the chief through the Force, however, that he'd realized just how difficult this might prove. These beings, it turned out, had two centers of consciousness. Where Luke might ordinarily have influenced any other creature's thoughts and convinced it simply to let them go, there was no one place to apply pressure within the chief of the Chryslaws. One thought center was bright and alert, and easily deflected his probe. The other was dull and diffuse, as slippery as a nuroop egg. He couldn't influence either as easily as he'd hoped, and the revelation threw him for a moment. He had never encountered this situation before. During his confusion, one of their stormtrooper escorts had been forced onto the ground. A robed Chryslaw tipped the stormtrooper's head back and, bizarrely, attempted to force some sort of wriggling grub down his throat. The man gagged and tried to spit it out, but the tiny creature went down anyway. That was enough for Luke. Giving up on direct control, he had used the Force to thrust the robed Chryslaw away from the fallen stormtrooper. The man's life signature was still strong, despite his revulsion at the unexpected meal. Pushing his own guards away, he had helped the stormtrooper to his feet while Jason quickly freed himself and the others. Within no time at all, they had broken free of the Chryslaws and were running for their lives. As they fled, Luke had heard the distinctive sound of the chief screeching commands to those gathered around him. Soon a group of 11 ritual hunters, as Hegarty thought of them, had formed and given pursuit. The chase through the decaying palace had been fast and furious, with two of the stormtroopers at the rear of the group being snatched up by the jaws and claws of their pursuers within seconds. The sound of their cries as the Chryslaws fell upon them was terrible to hear, but their deaths had given the others valuable seconds. When one of the Chryslaws was successful, all of the hunting party came to a halt to devour their prey. This was the first hint that Hegarty had received of the nature of the ritualistic hunting group comprised by the 11 Chryslaws. Maybe now, Luke hoped, with most of the 11 buried beneath the rubble, they would give up the chase. It was a nice thought, but Luke still didn't feel confident that they were out of trouble just yet. Even now, as they neared their objective at the top of the ceremonial mound, he didn't allow himself to embrace the relief that he could sense emanating from Stalgis and Hegarty. Self-confidence had a way of making one lower one's guard, and that could cost lives. He wasn't about to assume they had escaped until they had escaped. Finally, the slope eased, and they staggered onto the mound's wide stone summit. The Sentinel-class landing shuttle rested on an eroded bas-relief depicting a mythical battle between two hideous-looking deities. At the top of the extended landing ramp stood a gray-uniformed Imperial pilot, waving for them to hurry.
"Gee, what's the rush?"
Stalgis said dryly, putting an arm under the shoulder of the only other surviving stormtrooper, the one who'd been force-fed the grub. "Can't they allow us a few moments to admire the scenery?"
"Maybe that's why," Jason said, pointing ahead and to his left.
Approaching with an ungainly but effective series of long-legged leaps were the three Chryslaws who had separated from the rest of the hunting party at the base of the mound. It was clear they were going to reach the shuttle first, which probably explained their triumphant howls and ululations. Luke gathered the Force about himself and Jason. By using it to increase their speed, the two of them could head off the three Chryslaws, giving the others opportunity to get to the shuttle. Three of these creatures would certainly be no match for the lightsabers of two trained Jedi. Barely had he taken a step when matching howls sounded from off to the right. A quick glance told him that 8 more of the Chryslaws had found them.
11 again, Hegarty said breathlessly.
There was a hint of defeat in her tone.
They can't be the ones we buried, Jason said. It's not possible.
They aren't, Luke said. They have different markings. These must be replacements.
How did they know? Stalgis asked.
The question became moot as the 11 howling aliens converged on the escapees. Two Chryslaws separated from the rest and headed for the shuttle, giving the Imperial waiting at the top of the ramp good reason to hastily retreat inside. Seconds later, Laser cannons issued from their retractable housing and began taking pot shots. The Krizlaws were too fast, however, their long leaps taking the gunner by surprise. Luke stopped running. There was no point wasting energy on a mad dash if there was no chance of making it. Sending for the shuttle's speeder bike was also pointless, since that could save only two of them at the very most. A familiar meditation damped down feelings of frustration and anger. This was no time to give in to darker emotions, he told himself. There had to be another way to save the landing party from the approaching aliens. Stalgis assumed a sharpshooter's pose and snapped off a dozen rounds in quick succession. One of the Krizlaws stumbled and fell, missing one of its arms and geysering purplish blood. Luke watched in horror as the creature staggered back to its feet and continued on, limping. Stalgis's jaw clenched as if biting down on frustration, but he kept on firing. Luke and Jason placed themselves at two points of a defensive triangle, with Stalgis and the other stormtrooper at the other corner, and the exhausted Hegarty in the middle. The xenobiologist was only slightly older than Luke, but she had no battle skills. The type of expedition she was used to, Luke imagined, would have had little cause for running like this. Krizlaws spread out in a circle around them. Luke used the Force to discourage those who came closest, but knew it was only a matter of time before he and the others were rushed. There was no way they could possibly repel all nine at once. As he steeled himself in preparation for the inevitable attack, and possibly a fight to the death, his thoughts went out to his son, safe in the heart of the Galactic Alliance, and he sent a wordless message of apology to Mara, waiting in orbit in Jade Shadow. The Millennium Falcon's exit from hyperspace was anything but graceful. Leia gripped the arms of her co-pilot's chair, glad that Han had finally installed one that accommodated her slight build. Behind her, she could hear C-3PO rattling. "Oh, my!" the golden droid exclaimed, shifting unsteadily on his feet to try to keep his balance. "I hope we haven't hit anything." Han flicked a couple of switches. Then, when that obviously failed, he leaned back in his seat and kicked the base of the console. A few seconds later, their trajectory flattened out. "Sorry about that, folks," he said to no one in particular. "Normal services have been resumed." Leia rolled her eyes and glanced back at Tahiri. The young Jedi sat stoically in her seat, her stare fixed at a point outside the cockpit canopy. Throughout the journey, she had remained quiet and unresponsive to any attempts at conversation, her thoughts focused firmly inward. Leia hadn't pressed her. She sensed that some complicated healing process was taking place in the girl, and she was reluctant to disturb it. Nevertheless, there were times when she felt that a more direct approach might be appropriate, especially those times when Tahiri's brooding silences went on for hours at a stretch, never seeming to end. Tahiri's blackout on Galantos had been a startling setback, occurring at a time when Leia had believed that Tahiri could be on the mend. Still, there could be no faulting her reactions when she'd woken up. Without her well-honed Jedi instincts, they might not have reached orbit when they did, or indeed made contact with the mysterious Rin who had helped them escape. Leia inwardly sighed. Whatever was going on inside Tahiri, it was frustratingly inconsistent. The subspace receiver bleeped. Leia glanced at the scopes and opened the line. Captain Maine's voice issued from the comm speakers.
"Falcon, I await your instructions."
"Glad you could join us, Salonia," she said. "Have a nice trip. As pleasant a stroll as one can expect through hyperspace." Leia smiled at the captain's remark as she surveyed the planet before them. Bacara was a beautiful blue-green world known for its agricultural and repulsor lift exports. Its two moons had been heavily mined for materials used in the manufacture of the second Death Star. It was also right on the edge of the galaxy, diametrically opposite the corridor of worlds that had first fallen victim to the Yuuzhan Vong invasion. "From Bonadon to Bacara via Bathawi," was an old saying that suggested it was easier to get from the corporate sector to Bacara via a wide detour to Bothan space than it was to go straight through the core. with its dense overlap of mass shadows and treacherous hyperspace lanes. It also connected three high-tech but otherwise very different industrialized worlds. Where Bonadon was a desertified wasteland, Bacara was still verdant and pastoral, on the other end of the spectrum of environmental degradation. Belkaden, the first world attacked by the Yuuzhan Vong and one of Bonadon's relative neighbors, was in a spectrum of its own, its biosphere modified to suit the aliens' introduced biological factories. Leia hoped she never saw the day when such degradation stretched from one side of the galaxy to the other, linking all the worlds she knew in a terrible web of pain and sacrifice. If the day ever arrived when Shimra ruled over Bacara, then she would know that the end had truly come. For now, though, it still looked peaceful enough. Numerous satellites orbited the planet, and she imagined that it wouldn't be long before someone detected and hailed the Falcon and Pride of Solonia. Assuming that normal procedures were still being followed, all entries into the system were closely monitored. The Bacaran government was constantly alert for another Cyruvi invasion. After the first attempt 25 standard years before, four destroyers and cruisers, Intruder, Watchkeeper, Sentinel, and Defender, had been specifically constructed and installed to guard the system. Two of them, Watchkeeper and the Task Force flagship Intruder, had been destroyed when co-opted into service to the New Republic at Solonia and Centerpoint. That left only Defender and Sentinel to hold the fort. "Bring back any memories, Leia?" Han asked with a crooked grin as his hand reached out to squeeze hers briefly. She returned his smile but didn't respond directly. They had visited Bacara very early in their relationship. Under other circumstances, she might have let herself enjoy the reminder of those headier days. "Stand ready, Solonia," she told Maine. "See if you can raise the planetary network. Don't identify us. Use Solonia's registration codes." Maine responded in the affirmative, and Leia switched to another frequency. "Twin Sun 1, maintain formation unless ordered otherwise." "Understood." Jaina's voice came briskly from the cockpit of her X-Wing. The remaining fighters of Twin Suns surrounded the two command vessels in a flattened dodecahedron, missing one point. "Do you sense anything, Jaina?" Leia asked her daughter. "Nothing out of the ordinary. What about you, Tahiri?" "Huh?" The young Jedi snapped out of some deep thought. "I'm sorry, what?" "I asked if you were picking up anything unusual through the Force," Leia said. "Oh, no. Nothing yet, anyway." Tahiri closed her eyes as she sent her mind reaching out through space, seeking any echoes of the people on and around Bacara. "Tahiri's looking now," Leia told Jaina. There was a slight but meaningful pause from Jaina's end. Leia had noticed a definite reserve growing between Jaina and Tahiri, but she'd had no opportunity to discuss it with her yet. The present arrangement, with Jaina on duty more often than not and rarely aboard the Falcon, meant that there was simply no time to be alone together. If something had happened to get in the way of the friendship between the two young women, Leia had no idea what it was. "Okay," Jaina finally said. "We'll keep our sensors peeled." Han brought the Millennium Falcon around along a broad arc designed to end quite clearly in orbital insertion. Leia wanted no ambiguity that they were on a peaceful mission, despite their military escort. After the Rin's vague hints, she wasn't taking any chances. She opened a line to Solonia again. "Any word yet, Captain?" "Nothing," Maine replied. "We're picking up some light chatter, but not much else. There are a large number of vessels in parking orbit or in station docks. Most of them just look like freighters." "No launches?" "None detected." Leia considered this for a moment. "Keep hailing them," she said shortly. "They must be ignoring us or simply not noticing us.
Either way, they won't be able to keep it up much longer. Let's just stick to our course and see what happens. And be ready for anything. Understood?
Leia turned to Han. He sat in silence beside her, his brow pinched with worry.
You okay?
He looked at her and cocked one eyebrow.
Do I really need to say it?
He asked. She shook her head and sighed. He didn't need to tell her that he had a bad feeling about this. She could feel something was wrong, too. But without evidence, she had no reason to act any way other than normal. Finally, the subspace channel crackled, and a response came in.
Salonia, this is General Panib of the Bakaran Defense Fleet. Please state your intentions.
Leia remembered a Captain Grell Panib from an earlier visit to Bakara. She imagined it was probably the same person. A short, stiff-backed redhead, he'd had all the social graces of a hungry Wookiee. Maine ignored the request.
We're allies, Captain, looking for a docking vector.
I'm sorry, Salonia, but we're going to need more detail before we can give you one.
Of all the... Han muttered.
It's a perfectly reasonable request, the general went on, his voice taut with a tension Leia couldn't immediately fathom. There has been no notification of you coming.
General Panib, this is Leia Organa Solo.
She interrupted before Han could explode.
We have come to your planet on a diplomatic mission. We would have notified you in advance, but communications have been unreliable around here of late.
There was some hesitation from the general.
I appreciate what you are saying. There have indeed been problems with the communications networks. Nevertheless, I must insist that you now state your intentions for coming here.
Hey, how about you drop the attitude? Han responded hotly.
We're the guys who saved your skins from the Syruk a while back, remember?
I remember.
I recognized that beat-up old freighter the moment I saw her.
Leia hid a worried smile as she watched her husband bite down on an indignant retort.
But things aren't so simple anymore, Panib went on. We have something of a situation here at the moment.
What kind of situation? Leia asked.
You're not welcome here.
A new voice crackled over the restricted comlink frequency.
Go steal someone else's ships.
What?
Han exclaimed. It was clear this time that he didn't intend to hold back. His face reddened as he leaned forward to speak into the communit.
Listen, you...
Wait, Han.
Leia cut him off. He looked at her with an incensed frown, but did as she asked.
General Panib, is this person speaking with your authority?
Certainly not, the general responded, spluttering, and whoever it is shall be court-martialed as soon as—
You can't court-martial everyone, general,
the intruder mocked. He had distorted his voice to mask his identity.
You can't silence the truth indefinitely.
When I find out who's responsible for this, the general blustered, I swear that I shall have you—
The truth? Leia broke in. And just what is the truth?
There is nothing to discuss here.
The general's voice was rising as he lost control of the situation. We don't need you meddling in our affairs.
We aren't here to meddle,
Leia defended quickly. Although I will admit that we are concerned about your affairs. I believe you are in great danger, General. People masquerading as allies may have recently contacted you. I can assure you that they are not what they seem.
Whereas you are, I suppose.
This came from the person who had broken into the conversation, his voice dripping with derision.
At least they don't pay lip service to the idea of an alliance, while eroding our defenses and leaving us open to attack.
Leia bridled at this. We have never abandoned our allies.
Like you never abandoned Dantooine and Ithor,
the stranger shot back.
Or Duro, or Tinna, or...
cold fury welled up in her. "Every planet lost cuts us deeply. Every life lost cuts us deeper."
"I must apologize, Princess," Panab said anxiously. The general's tone had changed dramatically from a few minutes earlier, and he sounded genuinely apologetic. "We are doing our best to find the source of the transmission."
"I'm sorry, too, Princess," came the distorted voice of the intruder, "but I'm afraid that the time has come to find ourselves some new allies."
"Uh-oh," Han said from Leia's side, his eyes scanning the display in front of him.
"What is it?"
she asked. "Sentinel's launching bay's just opened," he said, shaking his head ominously. He pointed at the screen. Issuing from the launching bays of the cruiser Sentinel was a swarm of Cyruvi battle droids, coming directly for them.
"Whatever it was we came to stop, I think we might be too late."
"Uncle Luke, look!"
Jason guided his uncle into the double mind of one of the nearby Krizlaws. He had used the Force to cloud the brighter, more intense mind, but still the creature kept on coming. Somehow, the more doltish mind was enough to coordinate the body while the higher mind was elsewhere.
"And exactly how is this supposed to help us, Jason?" Luke asked. "Look closer," Jason pressed. "We're not dealing with single creatures here. They're symbionts."
"Two creatures combined?" Luke said dubiously.
"I don't see how that—"
But then suddenly, he did see. The higher, brighter mind of the creature belonged to the writer, and was the directing intelligence. It gave the orders that the body then carried out, no matter how wounded. The lower mind belonged to the body, which could keep going even with the higher mind disabled. Jason's theory certainly fit the evidence, and he was intuitively better at understanding animals than Luke was. But if he was right, then the lower mind should be more easily startled by pain. And if that was the case, why hadn't the one in which Jason had disabled the higher mind simply run away from Stalgis's blaster fire? He soon found out. The writing intelligences were ferocious killers, crudely intelligent but not open to reason. Trained to hunt, not to discuss differences, the pack would keep coming as long as some of the writers remained to keep the lower minds in check. Following Jason's lead, Luke sent his mind into another of the Krizlaws and clouded its controlling intelligence. It, too, continued to obey its higher mind's final instructions, snapping hungrily at the four people along with the rest of the pack. Luke and his nephew continued around the circle of beasts, one by one, confusing their higher minds. It was only after they had disabled the sixth creature that there was a noticeable change in behavior. The pack became less orderly, less focused, while their baying became more unsettled and aggressive. Luke could feel a note of alarm entering the remaining higher minds as the thoughts of those around them descended back to their natural, animalistic states. As fascinating as it might have been to observe, though, it wasn't helping the landing party. Two of the enraged creatures rushed the group and were repelled by the combined blaster fire from Stalgis and the injured stormtrooper. One of the Krizlaws collapsed with a yelp and a whimper at their feet. The other, having taken a blaster bolt to the throat, leapt away, spitting blood. Barely a second had passed when another attacked from the far side. Luke took this one out himself, stepping forward a single pace as he brought his lightsaber up in a glowing arc, stabbing at the beast's soft pink underside. It fell to the ground, but he hadn't killed it. The jaws of the alien continued to snap at Hegarty's feet as it scrambled relentlessly toward her. Stalgis brought the nozzle of his rifle around and placed a precise blaster shot into the side of the Krizlaw's head to finish it off. Two more attacked them, uncoordinated and clumsy, and Luke felt his world contract into a furious concentration of teeth and glowing red eyes, with bright flashes of energy, blade and bolt, adding a surreal counterpoint to the proceedings. Another Krizlaw lunged, extendable mouth open to engulf him. He swung his lightsaber again, this time with more force, using the thought of Mara and Ben to strengthen his resolve to stay alive. The blade cut through the creature's forelimbs, but it wasn't enough to halt its movement through the air. It connected solidly with Luke's chest, knocking him to the ground. Its huge, slavering jaws were suddenly centimeters from his face. Before he'd had the chance to bring his lightsaber up to defend himself, five blasts sounded from nearby, each one striking the alien's head. Mucus and blood splashed Luke's face, and the Krizla fell heavily to one side. He would have liked to offer his thanks to the stormtrooper who'd fired the shot, but he had already turned his attention to the other creatures attacking them. There wasn't time to be grateful. Luke climbed to his feet, bringing his lightsaber to bear in anticipation of the next onslaught. But there was none. All of the Krizla suddenly recoiled, each emitting a sound that was so high-pitched it hurt his ears. He remained in a defensive stance, dumbstruck, his blade still held in front of him, waiting for the attack that refused to happen. Around him, the air was thick with confused animal thoughts as the Krizlaws wheeled and fled, scrambling and leaping in an uncontrolled, chaotic mass for the lip of the plateau. Mystified, Luke turned to check the others. Stalgis had a cut to his forehead. The stormtrooper was bleeding steadily from a bite to his shoulder. Hagerty was unharmed. Jason favored his right leg as he snapped off his lightsaber and turned to face them, a look of satisfaction on his face. "You're doing, I presume?" Luke asked. "I managed to get a handle on the lower mines," Jason explained. "Finally. Once we'd knocked out enough of the riders, they were unable to assert themselves. The pack was frightened of us and took the first opportunity to get away."
"Is the pack a group mind, do you think?" Hagerty asked, clearly intrigued by the idea.
"Yes, with a fixed number of components forming a stable configuration," Jason added.
"Of course," Hagerty said. "There were always 11 of them. They probably evolved that way, and the creatures controlling them now simply took advantage of the configuration."
"And that's how they knew when some of their number had been killed," Jason said. "Whenever a vacancy was created in the group, there was always another Krizla to fill it, with the new ones automatically knowing as much as the others in the meld." Luke nodded in agreement. It made sense. Now was not the time to be discussing it, though. "We should get to the shuttle while we still can," he said. "I'd rather not hang around and wait for the chief to put together another group, this time with controlling intelligences intact." They did as he suggested, with Hagerty taking the lead. Stalgis assisted his injured comrade, while Jason and Luke brought up the rear. "Good work," he told his nephew as they walked. "And timely, too. I don't know how much longer we could have held them off." Jason nodded, his expression one of simultaneous relief and pride. "I had to do something. I couldn't let us be taken down by a pack of animals." "Never underestimate the power of the animal," Luke said soberly. "Sheer numbers can overwhelm the best of tactics. Along with not having any fear of death, it's possibly the most powerful weapon an enemy can have." They reached the landing ramp with no further incidents, although the baying of Krizlaws was a constant and eerie reminder of why they should get off this planet and never look back. Luke helped the injured stormtrooper into the shuttle and onto one of the craft's small cots. Stalgis followed close behind, grabbing a med pack on the way.
"He's going to have to be examined thoroughly," Hagerty said, speaking to the others in a hushed tone so that the stormtrooper wouldn't hear. "That force feeding he received could be dangerous."
"He seems okay now," Jason said, "apart from the shoulder wound. I think Dr. Hagerty is more concerned about internal injuries," Luke said, glancing over to where Stalgis was administering treatment to the injured trooper. Now that the fight was over, he certainly looked paler and weaker than he had outside. Hagerty nodded.
"We'll need to warn Widowmaker that he might require immediate surgery, as well as decontamination."
"But why?" Jason asked.
"You said the Krizlaws are symbionts," she explained. "But symbionts with what exactly?"
"Some other species, I guess," he said. The doctor nodded again.
Remember the missing Jostrans?
Jason blanched as Hegarty's point hit home. You don't really think...
She shrugged. Maybe they're not missing after all.
We'll let Teckley know, Luke said with a sinking feeling in his stomach that was nothing compared to what the stormtrooper would feel if he learned of their suspicions. He filed through the cabin while the others took seats preparatory for launch, his thoughts turning over the whole Krizlaw-Jostran affair. It all seemed to make sense now, as things often did in retrospect. The passage of Zonama Seacote through the system must have destabilized the local environment enough to encourage a warlike clan or subspecies of Jostrans to take over the Krizlaws, giving them a competitive edge. Zonama Seacote had been responsible for helping that particular clan, but it had been at the cost of the previous Jostran civilization. The pilot lifted off just as Luke reached the cockpit. He strapped himself in, watching the ground scanner as he did so. Another group of Krizlaw Jostrans was converging on the shuttle, and he silently gave thanks that they were no longer out there fighting. It would only have been a matter of time before they would have fallen to the creatures. Luke was grateful that the shuttle offered no parting shots as it swept a comfortable distance over the heads of the 11 snapping aliens. Once upon a time, the gunners aboard this craft might have strafed them as they launched, but Luke had repeatedly emphasized that their mission was a peaceful one, and that there would be no unnecessary loss of life, human or otherwise. Thus far, the Imperials had accepted his terms happily enough, with Captain Yage and Lieutenant Stalgis backing him up. Many of the crew, Stalgis included, had friends or family who were still alive because of the actions of the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances around Orinda. Nevertheless, there was a definite undercurrent of resentment. To some, he would never be anything more than the rebel boy who was responsible for the death of Emperor Palpatine. But regardless of their feelings toward him, he would never let their disrespect undermine his confidence or authority. He turned away from the thoughts, settling back into his seat as the shuttle sped skyward, leaving Manali Mafir behind him. He was relieved to be going home, or to the closest thing to home they had, anyway. "Hail Jade Shadow," he instructed the sensor officer. To Luke's surprise, Danny Quee took the call.
"I gather you had some trouble with the locals," the young scientist said.
"An argument over dinner, that's all. Is Mara there?"
"She's tied up at the moment, but she says not to worry. Can I pass on a message?"
"No, that's okay. But tell Teckley to take a shuttle over to Widowmaker. We have a patient for her."
"Who's injured?"
she asked quickly. Luke could tell without her having to say anything that she was worried it might be Jason. "A stormtrooper," he explained briefly. "It's not so much that he's injured." He fought for the right word. "He's just... infected, I guess."
"I'll warn Teckley to be ready. Did you learn anything useful about Zonama Seacote?"
"It's been here, as we thought, but not for many years."
"Another hit and run?"
"I'm afraid so. If we only knew what it was looking for, it would certainly improve our chances of finding it."
"It's a big galaxy," Danny agreed.
"Excuse me, sir," the pilot interrupted. "You've got a communication coming in."
"Sorry, Danny. Got to go."
Luke thanked the sensor officer and moved forward to where the holodisplay rested between the two forward seats. In the display he saw the solid figure of Arian Yage, captain of the Imperial frigate Widowmaker, Jade Shadow's official escort through the unknown regions. Her hair was tied back in its usual severe bun, and her expression businesslike.
"We have visitors," she said, wasting no time on pleasantries. 15 minutes ago, a Chiss corvette and 2 full squadrons of clawcraft entered the system. They are on a high-powered approach vector, clearly intending to lock onto our orbit."
"Communications?"
"None as yet, although we hailed them as soon as they appeared on the scopes. I've put the squadron on full alert."
"How long until they come within range?"
"Approximately 30 minutes."
"I'll make sure we're back by then," Luke said. "Keep an eye on them, Captain,
and keep me informed. Yage's image nodded and fizzed out. Then Luke sank wearily back into his seat. Two Chiss squadrons were more than a match for a dozen Imperial TIE fighters, but Jade Shadow with Mara at the controls was worth an entire squadron on its own. If it came to a fight, they would be evenly matched. He just hoped it didn't come to that. The last time he and Mara had entered Chiss space, in Thrawn's day, their dealings had been conducted amicably, if cautiously. Fatigue washed through him, and he tapped the Force to sweep it away. He was tired of fighting, yes, but he wasn't about to give up. Besides, there was nothing yet to suggest that the Chiss were looking for a fight. For all he knew, this might be the way they normally approached unidentified vessels found wandering in the unknown regions. The Chiss were efficient and pragmatic, to the point of appearing cold to those unfamiliar with their ways. Until Luke was certain of their intentions, he could do little more than wait. He moved back into the passenger cabin to check on the injured stormtrooper. The man was unconscious. The upper half of his uniform had been removed to enable Stalgis to get at the wound on his shoulder, and there was a sheen to his skin from perspiration. Stalgis was leaning over the stormtrooper, holding a stim shot, a look of concern on his face. He straightened when he saw Luke. "He's going down fast," Stalgis said. "I don't have the facilities here to check for new poisons, so we're going to need to get him to Widowmaker's Medical Bay fast." Luke motioned Jason to come forward. "See if you can hold his vital signs stable. We're moving as quickly as we can, but it might not be enough." His nephew bent down next to the stricken trooper and placed a hand on his forehead. Luke felt waves of healing energy pour off his nephew and into the stormtrooper. He placed one hand on Jason's shoulder to lend him strength. "Looks like we might have attracted attention to ourselves," Luke whispered to him. "What sort of attention?" Jason returned equally as softly. "Chiss." The trooper's condition worsened steadily as the shuttle roared up toward the orbit occupied by the mission's two central vessels. Luke could feel the man's immune system failing as the invader spread its chemical and genetic tentacles through his body, beating it into submission. Jason didn't suggest using the Force to kill it, and Luke knew he wouldn't until the choice between it and the trooper became absolutely clear. Hegarty watched with an expression of concern mixed with intense curiosity. Luke doubted whether the woman could ever not look worried. The lines in her face were permanently etched that way. For the sake of Stalgis, and in case their fear turned out to be unfounded, Luke refrained from asking the doctor if she'd ever seen anything like this before. They'd find out soon enough, or so he hoped anyway. The sensor officer stuck his head out of the cockpit. "Another communication, sir." Luke returned to the cockpit, leaving Stalgis and Jason to care for the stormtrooper. Yage's hologram was back.
"We've had a reply," she said.
"Commander Arolia of the Expansionary Defense Fleet wants to speak to the person in charge. I told her you were on your way back from the surface, but she said she wanted to speak to you immediately." "I guess you'd better put me through, then," he said. The co-pilot made way for him without having to be asked. Luke straightened his robes as he took the empty seat. Yage's face dissolved from the hollow field in a flicker of static. It was replaced a few seconds later with the image of the upper body of a blue-skinned woman dressed in a burgundy and black uniform. Her eyes were the deep red of her species, and her expression held nothing but blunt authority. Chiss matured quickly, but still Luke was startled by the fact that she looked no older than his niece, Jaina.
"You are Master Skywalker."
Her voice had all the warmth of a droid. Luke nodded curtly and said, "I am leader of a peaceful mission from the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances. We are in the middle of an emergency. I lost two of my crew in a ground fight with the natives of the planet below, and a third is seriously injured. If we don't get back to orbit in time, he'll die. Your arrival into this system has put my squadron on full alert, and means our docking procedures will be that much more complicated." If I should lose another because of your interference, I will be extremely...
Please do not threaten us, Skywalker.
The Chiss woman responded calmly, staring unblinking from the flickering holofield.
Our intention is not to impede your docking procedures, or any other of your procedures. I require only that you meet with me in person at the earliest possible convenience.
Of course, Luke said. We'll arrange it as soon as I return to the Widowmaker.
When or how you arrange it is irrelevant. Know, however, that I will not remain in this system for long. Comply with my request or face the consequences.
The image winked out.
Well, you heard the commander, Luke said to the pilot, who had watched the show with interest. I guess we'd better get moving.
All X-Wings,
came Jaina's voice over the subspace combat channel.
Lock S-foils in attack position. Clawcraft, arm and target approaching vessels. Battle plan A-7.
Copy that.
Jag returned on behalf of Twin Sun's Chiss pilots. Leia watched as the formation of fighters split into three groups. Two pairs in a triplet. Galactic Alliance and Chiss fighters flying alongside each other with perfect precision. The calm command in her daughter's voice made her proud. No matter how surprised by the sudden attack Jaina must have been, she didn't let it show. Neither was there any suggestion of concern for the fact that her squadron hadn't had any experience in combat against Cyruvi fighters. Any sign of composure that General Ponib had displayed earlier now evaporated totally in the face of this abrupt turnabout of events.
"Please wait," he urged frantically. "There's been a terrible misunderstanding."
"You bet there has," Han said.
"One we intend to clear up for you very shortly. Those ships belong to the enemy, and we'll knock them out of your skies if they come anywhere near us. You got that?"
"More launches," Leia said,
registering fighters coming from Defender.
"A-wings and B-wings this time. Not Cyrook."
Han glanced at the scanner board.
"Those had better be coming to help us, Ponib."
"Falcon, I beseech you not to order your ships to open fire."
All semblance of calm had left the general's voice. Only panic remained.
"All these ships comprise a peaceful envoy to ensure your safe passage to orbit."
"All of them?" Han snorted.
"Yeah, right. If enteching humans and using them to fly those fighters heading our way constitutes peaceful behavior, then I don't think we're speaking the same language. Those fighters have precisely 30 seconds to turn around before we start opening fire."
"Han, look at this," Leia said,
studying the display before her. It showed one of the Cyruvi vessels up close. The image was fuzzy, but clear enough to make out some details.
"Do those engine housings look familiar to you?"
Han frowned at the image.
"What about them?"
"They look an awful lot like ion jets to me."
"So,
since when did the Cyrook start using standard engines on their fighters?"
"What are you saying, Leia?"
"That there's more here than meets the eye," she said. "You'll note also that our transmissions are not being jammed."
Han's frown deepened as his instincts conflicted with what Leia was suggesting.
"It has to be a trick," he said, shaking his head. "They want us to drop our guard."
Leia wasn't convinced.
"It doesn't add up, Han. If they really wanted to do that, then why not just let us land first and then attack us?"
She could almost see the thoughts behind his eyes racing through his mind. What if Ponib was telling the truth? A mistake could be extremely costly. Then there was the matter of the mysterious intruder on the secure comm channels. He had been silent since the Cyruvi vessels had launched. If their intentions had been to stir things up between Ponib and the visitors, in order to ensure the worst possible reception of the alien fighters, then they had certainly succeeded.
"The pilots of those ships aren't human," Tahiri said, breaking into the discussion softly.
Leia turned to face the young Jedi. The girl's eyes were still closed, as though meditating.
"They're definitely alien, and—"
She hesitated for a second,
Then her eyes flickered open. Everyone's heard the stories about the Sairuk, and how awful entechment is. It's supposed to be agony, right?
Leia nodded, still remembering the look on Nuke's face when he had been rescued from the mighty Sairuvi vessel in which he'd been held captive years ago. Exposure to the perverted entechment technology, and to the life energy forcibly removed from those taken captive in battle with Bakura, had touched him profoundly.
"Well, these minds aren't suffering," Tahiri said. "They're clean."
"What are they, then?" Han asked.
"I don't know," Tahiri said. "I've never touched minds like these before."
When Leia stretched out her senses, she, too, could detect no trace of anything malevolent in the approaching fighters.
"I don't care if their minds are as serene as Alderaanian snow," Han growled. "They're still attacking us."
"Are they?"
Leia asked. It was all too easy to assume.
"We don't want to start a war by accident. Not if there's an alternative."
"And what if you're wrong, Leia? I don't want them to end up using Jaina as target practice out there."
"Nor do I, Han."
She touched his hand in reassurance, then spoke on the secure subspace comlink to the squadron.
"Twin sons, fall back to flank Salonia and Falcon. You are instructed not to fire unless we are fired upon. Understood?" "Understood, Falcon."
Apart from the slight hesitation in Jaina's voice, the order was accepted and acted upon immediately. In the face of the rapidly approaching swarm of Sairuvi fighters, the combined Chiss and Galactic Alliance squadron peeled away and swooped back to cover their command vessels. Han squirmed in his seat but didn't say anything more. Leia shifted uneasily in her seat also. She felt reasonably confident that she was doing the right thing, but she couldn't help feeling nervous at the same time. The last time she had come face to face with Sairuvi fighters had been on a war footing. She remembered the strength of the fighters' shields and their maneuverability in dogfights. And perhaps more vividly, she remembered how the alien capital vessels would collect survivors with their trooper scoopers in order to suck out their life energies and hurl them back at their former allies.
"Gunner standing by,"
announced Captain Main on Salonia as the fighters came within range. Leia held her breath. On the scanner board, she saw the alien fighters break formation and scatter to adopt a defensive wall around the incoming vessels, just as an escort would do. No shots were fired, and they stayed a discreet distance from both Falcon and Salonia. When the second contingent of ships arrived, the A-wings and B-wings slotted into the existing pattern with only a small amount of jostling. She exhaled with a heavy sigh.
"Thank the Maker," C-3PO said from behind her.
"You can say that again, Goldenrod." Han leaned forward to trim the Falcon's course slightly, a motion designed to disguise the relief he was feeling, Leia knew. "We're not out of the woods yet. In case nobody has noticed, we're now effectively caught."
"But at least we didn't start a war," Leia said. "And this way, we just might get some answers."
"What if we don't like what we hear?" her husband asked wryly. Leia shrugged.
"We'll deal with that as it happens."
Han turned to the comm. Panib, who had been frantically trying to attract their attention over the subspace channel, sounded like he was going to sob with relief.
"Thank you, Falcon. You won't regret this."
"We'll reserve judgment on that until we hear what's going on," Han said.
"I understand,"
the general responded. "But first I must once again ask that you state your intentions." Han put a weary hand to his forehead. Leia gave in.
"We'd like to sit down at Salus Dar," she said, "and meet with Prime Minister Kundertal."
"I'm afraid that won't be possible," Panib said. "The Prime Minister is unable to meet with anyone at the moment."
"I don't understand, General,"
Leia said.
"Why?"
"Bakura is currently operating under martial law," he explained without allowing her to finish her question. "I shall be in charge until the crisis is over."
"Then perhaps we should meet with you," Leia said.
"Whatever this crisis is, I'm sure we can do something to help you out of it."
Your help would indeed be welcome, the general said, although he didn't sound overly enthusiastic. However, Salus Dar is unsafe for you at the moment. Dock with Sentinel, and I shall take a shuttle to meet you within the hour. I'll explain everything then.
Understood, Hans said. Leia noted the look of skepticism on his face.
Just don't try and tell us that the Cyrook are now the good guys, though, because I can tell you now we won't believe you.
Not the Cyrook, Panib said. The Pwek. Realization dawned, then, for Leia, and from Han's face she could tell it had for him, too.
Okay, General, she said. We'll see you within the hour.
The comm went dead.
The Pwek, Tahiri repeated. Weren't they the slaves of the Cyrook?
They were indeed, Leia said.
But how?
I guess that's what we're about to learn, Han said, the tension in his posture already easing. He reached forward to punch a new course into the Falcon's command board. In the meantime, let's show these reptoids how to fly. Leia relayed the situation to Captain Mayne as Han sent the Falcon streaking towards Sentinel. While she could understand his readiness to accept the immediately obvious explanation, she preferred to reserve judgment until she'd heard what Panib had to say. Nothing, she knew, was ever quite as simple as it seemed.
Only by force of will was Jason able to hold on to the contents of his stomach as he watched Tekly operate on the injured stormtrooper. The man lay face down on the operating table, naked to the waist and fed by numerous intravenous drips and tubes. They had barely reached the Widowmaker's medical bay in time. Had it not been for Luke and himself propping up the trooper's defenses with large amounts of the Force, the alien invader would have probably overtaken his immune system completely and effectively killed him. As it was, Saba 17 still had to strengthen the stormtrooper while Tekly tried to isolate the organism, carefully cutting through and around delicate tissues with her vibroscalpel. It was difficult and dangerous work, but after almost 45 minutes of painstaking surgery, Tekly seemed to have finally exposed the problem. The centipede-like creature the stormtrooper had been force-fed on Manlali Mothir had turned out not to be a meal at all, but rather, as Hegarty had suspected, an uninvited guest. The juvenile Jostran had survived the acids in the man's stomach long enough to burrow its way into his abdominal cavity and locate his spine. Once there, it had used the tips of its many legs to infiltrate nerves and tunnel into his spinal column. It had been working its way up to his skull, gradually taking over his body as it went. Tekly had caught it at the very top of the man's spine, just as it was about to invade his brain pan. Its central body had already sent dozens of hair-like tendrils snaking into delicate neural tissues, and these were making extraction exceedingly difficult. Tekly didn't doubt that the creature had numerous defense mechanisms designed to discourage removal. The filaments could physically damage nerve cells during extraction, or they could excrete any number of chemicals designed to kill as much tissue as possible around themselves. Only with the help of Jason was she able, strand by strand, to finally save the stormtrooper from a horrible fate. Jason attuned his mind to that of the Jostran and kept it docile while Tekly worked, finding it much easier when it was on its own rather than in a pack of 11. Jason couldn't shake the ghastly thought of what might have happened, as Tekly scooped up the wriggling body of the alien and dropped it into a tissue sample container. Hair-thin tendrils trailed it like roots from a plant.
"Well done, my friend," he said. "Master Silgall would be proud of you."
"Thank you, Jason," Tekly said, stepping back from the table and removing her gloves, leaving a medical droid to suture the patient's wound. "But perhaps we should save congratulations until the anesthetic wears off."
The Chadrafan's ears were limp with fatigue, and her fur appeared dull. It was clear that the intense concentration required for the operation had taken a lot out of her.
"You're exhausted," Jason said.
She nodded.
"I feel as tired as you look."
Jason acknowledged the comment with a tight smile. He hadn't had time to change from the gear he'd worn on Manlali Mothir.
He'd only had time to wash the dirt and sweat off his face and hands. In all, he suspected he looked as exhausted as he felt. They left the patient in the care of Imperial Meditex. Outside the surgery, they met Lieutenant Stalgis, waiting in the narrow corridor. He had removed his helmet, revealing a long, lined face that suggested an age much older than his 30 or so years. But, like Jason, he hadn't had time to fully refresh himself yet.
"How is he?"
"He's fine," Jason reassured him. "He just needs time to recover from the surgery." "The thing, the Jostran." Stalgis's face contorted into a look of revulsion. "Has it?"
"It's been removed."
Relief rolled off the lieutenant in waves. "I can't tell you how grateful I am to both of you. Tarl is a friend, as well as a member of my ground team. If he had died, if we hadn't made it back in time—" Stalgis gesticulated for lack of words. Jason placed a hand on the armor plating of the man's upper arm. "We were glad to help, but I suggest you get some rest now. Your friend is going to need you when he wakes." Stalgis nodded almost formally and strode off up the hallway.
"Perhaps you should listen to your own advice, Solo."
Jason turned to find Danny Quee standing behind him. She was smiling, but there was no mistaking the concern underlying it.
"I'm okay. You're tired," she said, her green eyes flashing at him. "And don't even try to deny it."
A touch on the back of his hand signaled Tekli's departure. He sent a wave of gratitude to the Chadrafan through the Force, then devoted all his attention to Danny. She stood before him wearing a standard Jedi expeditionary suit with her arms folded across her breasts. Her blonde, curly hair had been cut to her shoulders.
"It's true," he admitted, stepping closer. "I am tired. In fact, I'd give anything right now to be able to curl up on my bunk and sleep for a day or two."
"Not even an attempted denial," she said. "I'm impressed, Jason. Unfortunately, there won't be time for you to sleep. You're wanted on the bridge now." Momentary alarm welled up in him, but he pushed it back down.
"Is anything wrong?"
"Nothing that can't wait 10 minutes for you to clean up."
"Is it the Chiss?" he pressed.
"In 10 minutes, you'll have all the answers you need. But if you were to meet Commander Irolia looking like this, it would probably be taken as a declaration of war."
"She's not letting us proceed?"
Danny continued to evade his questions. "Illegal use of biological weapons or something?"
"At least give me a hint."
"Cruel and unusual punishment."
"All right, all right."
Smiling and feeling energized by the brief exchange, they walked along the narrow corridor of the Imperial frigate to the cabin he'd been assigned. "Tell Uncle Luke I'll be there shortly. That's what comlinks are for." Her expression was mock indignant, but turned into a smile as she turned and headed off for the bridge.
"The planet is a legend,"
Commander Irolia said. Her youthful features were set in stubborn, self-assured lines.
"I cannot believe that finding it is your true objective."
"I assure you that it's much more than a legend," Master Skywalker said. Saba was amazed at his self-control. She knew that he was exhausted and irritated, but all he allowed his face to display was calm and patience. "We have evidence that it once existed. The only question is whether it still exists today."
"What evidence is this?"
"We were told about Zunama Seacoat by Vergere, a Jedi Knight from—"
"Vergere?"
Irolia's eyebrows shot up at the name.
"The same Vergere who sabotaged the Alpha Red Initiative?"
Master Skywalker didn't flinch from the truth. "The Vergere who prevented genocide the likes of which this galaxy has never seen? Yes." The commander's exhalation had a mocking bite.
"You expect me to trust her testimony?" "No one is forcing you to accept anything,"
Captain Yates said, clearly annoyed by the Chiss commander's mockery.
"We only want to go about our business, that's all." "But what is your business? That's what I am attempting to determine."
The meeting was being conducted on Widowmaker's Bridge in full view of the crew. Aerolia carried herself as though it was her own ship and her own crew. Her tone and poise displayed nothing but self-assurance. Saba knew that. Should anything happen to the Chiss officer or the small contingent of guards that had escorted her across, then there would be dire consequences for Master Skywalker and his expedition. What's more, Aerolia knew that they knew, and that, presumably, was why she was so confident. Saba wasn't an expert on humanoid appearances, but she imagined that the Chiss commander would have been regarded as quite striking among her own people. Her face was narrow and angular, her blue skin smooth and soft-looking. Her wide red eyes contained both character and intelligence, and upon entering the meeting had quickly scanned everyone on the bridge. She didn't doubt that the woman's evaluation of them would have been equally as brisk. "All we ask," Luke said, "is for the freedom to look." Aerolia paced three steps to her left, contemplating his words. "This is our territory," she said. "You do realize that?" "We recognize your authority over regions near here, yes. But we weren't aware that the expansionary defense fleet had specifically annexed this system."
"If I were to tell you that we have, would you leave?"
"We are a peaceful expedition," Luke said. "Would you bar a trading mission from your territory, or a scientific team?" The commander laughed.
"Don't try to fool me, Skywalker. You're no more a traitor than I am. And as for your motives being scientific, I ask this of you. Were you to find this planet, what exactly would you do with it?"
A new voice spoke up from behind them when Luke hesitated. "It is our hope that Zonama Seacoat will help us in our war effort, and in doing so save trillions of lives, including your own." Commander Aerolia turned her attention to Jason Solo, who had just entered the room.
"Then your intentions are clearly not scientific, but rather military. So why should we allow you to pursue such objectives when you so readily interfere with our own?"
"Alpha Red wouldn't have won the war," Luke said calmly. "It would have turned us all into monsters." "That's the war I'm talking about," Jason said, stepping down into the center of the circular bridge to join the others. "The war against ourselves." Aerolia took a long moment to consider this.
"It surprises me to see Imperials and the New Republic working alongside each other," she said finally.
"We are no longer referred to as the New Republic," Luke said. "We have a new name now, the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances."
"And the Empire has freely joined this alliance?"
Aerolia asked, glancing at Yage.
"It has," the captain said. "I suppose the Chiss are welcome to join, too."
Luke seemed unfazed by the commander's sarcasm. "The decision would be yours. But yes, you would indeed be welcome to join in due course." Aerolia snorted derisively, but didn't address the Jedi Master's comment. Instead, she said,
"What concerns me the most here, I think, is the makeup of your senior crew."
Master Skywalker shrugged. "I have already explained that the military contingent is purely defensive."
"That might indeed be true, but the intention lies in its leaders. Mara Jade Skywalker, Luke Skywalker, Jason Solo, all renowned Jedi warriors."
"Danny Quee is an accomplished scientist," Jason pointed out.
"Yes, I recognize that name. And Soren Hegarty, we know, of course. They fit in with your stated aims."
Danny looked both startled and flattered to be recognized. Hegarty, on the other hand, showed no reaction at all.
"But you also have a Barabel among you," Aerolia continued. "How does it fit in?"
Saba stiffened. "She is a Jedi Knight," Luke said.
"Another warrior, then?"
"Not in the sense that you mean."
"Really? Most reptilian species I've ever met have been aggressive and predatory."
Saba's tail thumped the floor. She couldn't help it.
Captain Yage took a step forward at this. "Tell me, Commander,
How would you feel if I were to tell you that most Chiss I've met have been arrogant and condescending?"
Luke signaled for patience. "Saba is life-sensitive. We hope that she will detect Zonamasikot by its force emissions when we are near it."
"Have you had any luck so far in this?"
"Not yet. That's why we need to keep searching."
Irolia nodded after some thought. "Very well, Master Skywalker. I would agree to this only because we, too, would like to see this war brought to an end."
She signaled to her bodyguards, who handed her a flat, rectangular package about the same size as her outstretched hand.
"This memory disk contains authority codes and routes sufficient to get you to Scylla. They will remain active for 1 week. In that time, you must present yourself in person to obtain permission to travel within our boundaries. Without that permission, any trespass will be regarded as an act of aggression, upon which you will be expelled or destroyed. Do I make myself clear?"
Luke accepted the disk with a resigned look. "Abundantly clear."
"Then my mission here is complete."
Commander Irolia's gaze briefly swept the room.
"Perhaps we shall all meet again on Scylla." "That's all you came here for?" Captain Yage asked. "To tell us to report to your superiors?" "Not quite," Irolia answered. "I was ordered to give you the disk only if I thought you trustworthy."
"And if we weren't?"
The Chiss commander smiled at this, but said nothing in reply. She simply nodded farewell and, with an imperious gesture, ordered her bodyguards to follow her as she strolled from the bridge.
"Why, that trumped-up little—"
Again, Luke silenced Captain Yage with a gesture. "She's just doing her job, Arian. We can't blame her for that.
Nevertheless, I'll be happier when she's off my ship."
She turned away to coordinate the disembarkation of the Chiss shuttle.
"I can understand perfectly where you're coming from, Captain Yage."
The hologram broke into static, then cleared to reveal the face of Mara Jade Skywalker at the controls of Jade Shadow.
"I don't even want that woman on my scopes."
"You caught all that, Mara?" Luke asked, facing the image of his wife in the hollow field.
"Loud and clear." "What gets up my jets," Yage said, "is the assumption that we're answerable to them at all. The Empire has been collaborating with the Chiss for years, ever since Thrawn's day. But there's no treaty. We don't owe them anything. Just the idea of having to report our every movement to them makes my hair stand on end."
"We have to respect that we're in their territory now, Arian," Luke said, "and they do things differently than we do."
"Assuming we are in their territory," Mara said, "how about looking at that disk?"
Jason took it from his uncle and put it into a reader. As Irolia had promised, it contained routes and security codes, but nothing else. The Chiss were tight-lipped when it came to doling out information. They were lucky to get this much. "Thoughts, anyone?" Luke asked. "Do we plow on regardless, or should we comply with their request and report in?"
"It's your decision," Yage said.
"Yes, but to reach that decision, I would like to hear everyone's opinion."
"I don't think there's any great harm in doing what they say," Mara said, "even though it does irk me." "I say to the Maw with them," Yage put in. "They can't tell us what to do."
Luke nodded quietly to both women's comments.
"Jason?"
"We'll need access to their information," his nephew replied. "It would make things much simpler. Soren's data is accurate, but doesn't cover more than 10% of the unknown regions." The xenobiologist had looked slightly bored throughout the political exchange, but seemed to perk up now that she'd been brought into the conversation.
"The Chiss have been expanding through this section of the galaxy for decades. Irolia clearly knew of the legend of the wandering planet, so it must be common knowledge among her people. I believe access to their data would be invaluable."
"But would it actually make the difference, do you think?" Luke folded his hands in front of him, as he so often did when pondering weighty matters.
"It certainly might."
Hagerty nodded at the map. "This small amount of data has already told us something interesting. Note the outer edge of their territory. See how it is held firm against the Yuuzhan Vong incursion? They have either developed similar jamming and combat techniques as your own fighters, or the enemy has withdrawn its offensive in order to concentrate on other areas. I would imagine that the answer to this mystery would be of interest to your tacticians back home."
There was a general murmur of agreement following that observation. The heads of the Galactic Alliance seemed an awfully long way from the unknown regions, but Hagerty and Aurelia was quite right. Luke's mission was military, at least in the sense that any information of military value would immediately be added to the war effort. Even though galaxy-wide communications didn't reach into the unknown regions, subspace transmissions could be relayed through an isolated holocom on the edge of Galactic Alliance space. All communications from the mission were relayed to Calomus immediately. Luke nodded.
"You might be right. But tell me, Saba, have you detected any sign of Zonama Seacoat in this vicinity? If we are hot on its scent, then we might not need to contact the Chiss at all."
Saba straightened, her nostrils flaring involuntarily. "I sense nothing. If Zonama Seacoat is here, it is well hidden."
"I thought as much. It's like looking for a droid in a desert. Something's more likely to find us before we find it."
He nodded again.
"I'm of the opinion that we should do as Aurelia says, and check in with the local authorities. As Soren said, it couldn't hurt. And, who knows, it might actually help." He glanced around to everyone, as though waiting to see if there were any objections to his decision. When no one spoke up, he said, "Okay, then. I'll leave the details of the course with Mara and Arian to prepare. Those of us who just came back from Monlali Mafir will need a break before we take on anything else."
Captain Yage smiled. "I'm sure you won't get any argument from Dr. Hagerty on that score."
The meeting broke up, then, leaving Mara Jade Skywalker and Captain Yage to discuss the finer points of the Chiss map. Luke motioned to Saba, Jason, and Hagerty, and they joined him for a quiet discussion near the bridge's exit. "How did Tekle get on with the Jostran?" was the first thing he asked his nephew.
"It was touch and go for a while," the young Jedi replied. "Another centimeter, and it would have been too late. But she caught it."
"That's good," the Jedi Master said with a solemn expression. "I would have hated to lose someone else." The reminder of the two stormtroopers killed on Monlali Mafir was sobering.
"This one has examined the data you gathered, Master," Saba said. "There is a correlation with the other regions through which Zonama Seacoat is recorded to have passed. The Jostran Krizlaw symbionts are not technologically advanced, so they do not pose an immediate threat. But they are aggressive by nature. The living planet seems to have exhibited similar avoidance tactics elsewhere."
"The Krizlaws are certainly aggressive," Luke agreed. "That the Jostrans gave them intelligence only made them worse. I wonder, then, could this be what it's running from? After all, we know Zonama Seacoat has a strong presence in the Force. It might be simply trying to hide itself from anything it associates with violence."
"It is possible," Saba said.
There followed a moment of pensive silence. Saba suspected the silence was due more to weariness than anything else. Her sensitive nostrils could smell the exhaustion emanating from the three humans around her, especially Master Skywalker and his nephew.
"You must rest," she said to them. "It will be no good to anyone if you do not."
"You're quite right, Saba," Luke said. "I was just thinking about Diff Scour. He's obviously told his side of the story to the Chiss."
Saba nodded. Scour was the head of New Republic Intelligence. He had worked extensively with the Chiss scientists on the virus Alpha Red,
which would have completely wiped out the Yuuzhan Vong and all their biotechnology had it been brought into play. That the Jedi had put a stop to the plan irked Scour. He might not be above taking steps to thwart the Master's own plans in return. "We'll see what's waiting for us at Scylla," Jason said, his gaze drifting to where Danny Quee stood on the far side of the bridge. "Forewarned is forearmed." "But forearmed can lead to a foregone conclusion," Luke pointed out. "We shouldn't jump ahead of ourselves. The last thing we need now is a self-fulfilling prophecy."
"Just the usual sort," Saba said, hissing with amusement.
But as so often happened when she attempted a witticism, nobody laughed. They just looked at her strangely. The first thing Tahiri noticed as she stepped over the threshold into Sentinel was the tension. It was like an overwhelming odor emanating from everything around her. The air, the walls, the floors, the light fittings. Even from the people themselves. She winced. It was more a physical reaction to something she was sensing through the Force. What caused it, however, she couldn't tell. She just knew it was there. The second thing she noticed was the briskness of the salute Princess Leia and Han received as they stepped through the airlock. The guards, dressed in dark green uniforms, fairly jumped to attention like wires snapping taut. She didn't think the reaction came from any Palpatine-style discipline, though. Bacara was a peaceful world, with no history of dictators since the last Imperial governor, Nereus, had been overthrown during the Cyruvi crisis. More likely, she thought, the guards were reacting to the same tension in the air that she had detected. Something was making everyone jumpy. A short, stiff-backed man with thinning red hair and a mustache stepped through the lines of Bacaran security guards. "Grel Panib," he said by way of introduction, bowing sharply first to Leia, then Han. The rest of the party, herself, Jaina, C-3PO, Leia's Nogri bodyguards, and a small honor guard from Pride of Salonia, were acknowledged with a curt nod. "Welcome to Bacara." "It's been a while," Han said dryly. "You served under Pater Thanis, didn't you?" Princess Leia didn't miss anything. A glimpse of sadness passed across General Panib's face. "You have a fine memory, Princess. We barely met."
"It was a memorable trip."
She smiled as though at some private joke, then introduced the rest of the party. "Thank you all for—" Panib began, but a commotion from behind the security guards interrupted him. There was the sound of scuffling as someone pushed forward. "I told you to wait for me to call you." "Not someone," Tahiri thought, her heart suddenly pounding, as through the tangle of people she glimpsed a reptilian creature bounding toward them. "Something." She instantly drew her lightsaber as the memory of her dreams lifted to emphasize her fears. "Tahiri, Tahiri, Tahiri." The godlike lizard creature from her dreams beckoned her. She blinked once, twice, to clear her head as her lightsaber crackled in front of her. "A trap!" Jaina shouted. She, too, withdrew her lightsaber. At the same time, the stormtroopers raised their blasters and the Nogri guards stepped forward to protect the princess. "No." Panib quickly put himself between the reptilian creature and their weapons. "His intentions are not hostile." The creature emerged from the line of security guards, its claws skittering piercingly on the corridor floor as it came to a halt behind the general. The alien was a beaked reptile with a long, muscular tail. Its scales were a dull brown, and beneath prominent ridges its golden eyes danced alarmingly. It wore a leathery harness to which were strapped numerous items that could have been either tools or badges of rank. "This is Luathen," General Panib said, clearly unsettled by the visitor's reaction. "I assure you that—" A sudden burst of piercing tones from the creature interrupted him. When it was over, Han pretended to clean out his ear. "Did anyone catch that?"
"I did, sir,"
C-3PO answered, oblivious to the fact that it had been a rhetorical question. "He says that he is the advance leader of the Prek Emancipation Movement, and that he welcomes us. He refers to us as allies of the free." Tahiri felt the uncertainty of those around her as more loud fluting sounded from the creature. "I mean you no harm," 3PO translated. "Well, that makes me feel a whole lot easier," Han said in a tone that suggested the exact opposite. "I do apologize for this," Ponib said. "The Pwek are unaccustomed to advanced protocol, human or otherwise. They've only recently thrown off their shackles and started speaking for themselves, as it were." Leia called for everyone to put their weapons away as she eased past the Nogri bodyguards, who parted for her without protest. She stepped up to Lwathan, wearing a thin, perhaps nervous, smile.
"3PO, tell Lwathan that we are pleased to meet him," she instructed the protocol droid. "If indeed he is a him."
"He assures us that he is," Ponib said, "and there is no need for your droid to act as mediator in your dialogue with him, either. He can understand what you're saying perfectly well. We don't like using droids much here, so if you prefer, we can supply you with earpiece translators that will do the job equally as well." 3PO bristled at the suggestion that his talents might be unnecessary or even distasteful.
"With all due respect, sir, I was designed for precisely this kind of situation. I am fluent in over 6 million languages, and—" "What he's saying, General," Leia interrupted, "is that we'll get by."
Lwathan's nostril tongues tasted the air as he followed the exchange. The Pwek was smaller than an average Syru, although not by much. But he was still bigger than the average human. Muscles bunched under his leathery skin, and his thick tail swished back and forth in a regular, easy rhythm. It was an alarming presence, made all the more unsettling when Tahiri looked up into the creature's face to find his three-lidded amber eyes staring out at her, almost as if reading her reservations. She knew that Leia had instructed everyone to lower their weapons, but Tahiri found her thumb still hovering over the activation stud of her lightsaber.
"You bring Jedi Knights," Lwathan sang through C-3PO. "I had hoped to meet one. The lightsaber is a delightful weapon, an elegant blend of life energy and material design. Our divergent technologies become one in such devices."
Leia's cautious attitude became markedly frostier.
"You still use Entechment?"
Ponib stepped forward again.
"I don't think this is either the time or the place for such involved discussions. Perhaps we should move to surroundings more comfortable for all species."
"Yes?"
"We're not going anywhere until Leia gets an answer," Han said, his hand back on his blaster. "I'm not about to have my life energy sucked out of me while my guard is down."
Lwathan danced agitatedly on the spot, fluting urgently to C-3PO.
"He assures us that the process is not the same as you remember it," the golden droid informed them. "It has been refined considerably. The Pwek come in peace, he says, not war."
Han looked around suspiciously.
"Leia?" "As uncomfortable as I am about all of this," Leia said, "I don't see the point in turning back now."
She faced Ponib. "But understand this. The Galactic Federation of Free Alliances will never sanction any form of alliance with a government that exploits the life energy of its subjects, no matter who they are or were."
"You think the Pwek are getting back at their old masters?" Ponib said. "I can assure you that's not the case."
"No one is intact against their will anymore," C-3PO continued to interpret. "If you let us, we will explain."
Leia nodded solemnly.
"I'd like to hear that. And then maybe you can also explain what's happened to Prime Minister Kundertal."
Ponib bowed, and Lwathan jigged on the spot.
"Please follow me," General Ponib said.
Han came up alongside Leia and gently put an arm about her, and together they walked in the General's footsteps as he led them deeper into the Sentinel. Jaina and Tahiri followed, C-3PO between them and the Galactic Alliance guards behind. Jaina was a picture of controlled energy, eyes glancing all around, except at Tahiri. It was as if she was deliberately avoiding her eyes. That hurt Tahiri. Jaina had exchanged barely a monosyllable with her since Galantos, and Jagfell was no better. Every now and then, she felt as though they were watching her from afar. They hadn't had to say anything. She could feel their distrust in her, and that hurt her more than any words could ever hope to. As they walked off together, Tahiri felt the scars on her forehead itching. She fought the urge to scratch. She felt self-conscious about them as it was, without drawing any more attention to the unsightly markings. The self-inflicted ones on her arm had all but healed and remained hidden beneath the sleeve of her tunic. She had considered getting rid of them, but had decided to keep them, for now, out of an instinct she didn't entirely understand and didn't want to think about too closely. There were far more important things to dwell upon. Sentinel boasted a large meeting hall on an outer level, with a transparent ceiling that afforded a magnificent viewport to the stars. During combat, steel-crete shields would slide shut over the top for protection, but during more tranquil times, it offered a wonderful view of Baccarat. The green-blue world hung like a fat moon above a ring-shaped conference table that floated on a bed of repulsors. There were enough seats for everyone who had entered the hall, but only those who'd be involved in the discussions were invited to sit around the table. Jaina stood directly behind her parents, her hand on the hilt of her lightsaber. She didn't like being so far away from reinforcements in such an unknown situation, and having her weapon within constant reach went a long way toward easing her apprehensions. Everyone knew that the Sai-Rook were adept at mental coercion. Who was to say that General Panib wasn't a brainwashed slave intending to deliver the delegates from the Galactic Alliance to his masters at the first opportunity? The presence of the Prek didn't particularly reassure her, either. In fact, when two more of the creatures had joined Lothan, Jaina's misgivings had intensified immediately. She assumed them to be bodyguards by the way they took up position behind Lothan, although she had to admit they didn't look any different in appearance from their superior. They wore odd-looking weapons fastened to their harnesses, flat disks with business-like snouts protruding from one end. Paddle beamers, she assumed. The energy beams of such weapons couldn't be deflected by lightsabers, but they could certainly be bent a little. Lothan himself did not have a physique that allowed him to sit on chairs like the others present, so he was sprawled out on an assortment of cushions at his appointed place around the table. This didn't detract in any way from his intimidating mien. Blaine Harris, the Deputy Prime Minister, is on his way from Salus Dar, Panib said by way of preamble. But we shall begin without him. I wouldn't say we're a captive audience, Han said, sitting restlessly at Leia's side, but we're prepared to hear you out. You've come at a very awkward time for us. I hardly know where to begin. You could start with entechment, Leia said. We know that you think it an abomination, Lothan said through C-3PO, and I can sympathize with your feelings. My species has been exploited by it for thousands of years. We know it's past evil. Be that as it may, Han said. I've seen plenty of slaves point the same weapons at their masters once they'd won their freedom. I'll admit the temptation was strong, Lothan said, his beak clicking together at the end of the short phrase. But perhaps I should tell you the story of how we came to be here. Maybe then you will understand us better. Jaina saw her mother nod for him to continue, then settled back into the large, upright chair to listen. It has been almost 30 years since the Sairuvi Imperium waged war in this section of the galaxy, he began. Jaina knew the story. Initially courted by Emperor Palpatine, the Sairuvi Imperium had expanded aggressively into Imperial territories, starting with Baccarat. Unfortunately for the Sai-Rook, that advance had been immediately repelled by the local Imperial government, with the unlikely help of the Rebel Alliance. Further incursions into the galaxy were discouraged by the New Republic, which forced the Imperium back to its homeworlds. Nothing had been heard from them since. Jaina gathered that everyone assumed they either had learned the error of their ways or were gradually stockpiling for a more determined surge. Just like the Avitha, she thought. In fact, Lothan said, our former masters were assessing more than just their tactics in the wake of their defeat. Cyruvi society was strictly clan-based, he explained, with each clan designated by the color of their scales. The absolute ruler was the Shrieftut, assisted by the Elders' Council and the Conclave. The Conclave advised the Shrieftut on spiritual matters. Another aspect of life considered very important by the Cyruk. Their belief system taught that the spirit of any Cyru, who died away from a consecrated world, would be lost forever. It was for that reason that the Cyruk preferred to use combat droids powered by the intact souls of captives to fight their enemies, rather than risk their own lives in battle. Entekmet had served our masters well for many centuries. They had never seen any reason to change. The abhorrence with which you greeted the technology came as a complete surprise to them. They had assumed that all cultures would employ the same techniques. That you didn't only underscored the novelty of the technology you did use, that of fusion and ordinary matter. Clearly, the Rebel Alliance beat our former masters for more reasons than different technology, but that was one aspect they could focus on. They had seen Imperial and Rebel Alliance vessels in action above and around Baccarat. They knew enough material physics to back-engineer the technology and recreate it in their laboratories. Within 10 standard years, they possessed prototype hybrid vessels that employed your technology for shields and engines, but were directed by intact minds. With a significantly reduced drain on their life forces, such pilots existed much longer and in less agony than before. But they were still intact. Han interrupted. Yes. The mind of every prototype droid fighter consisted of a soul stolen from the body of a Pwek. The fact that their suffering had been lessened was balanced by the fact that they suffered longer. The situation was still undeniably wrong. Into this time, the Kiramak was born. A new note entered the Pwek's voice. It might have been fear, Jaina thought, or maybe awe. What is this Kiramak? Leia asked. It is hard to explain in terms that you might understand. You know that those of the Cyruk with blue scales ruled the Cyruvi Imperium, and that the gold scales were our priests. Yellow scales studied the sciences of matter and energy. Those with russet scales were our warriors, while those with green scales were workers. Below them, barely above my own species, were those resulting from a mixed or unsuccessful breeding, the brown scales. Some suspected them of being the progenitors of the Pwek in ages past. Regarded as dim-witted and brutish, they were fit only for the most menial of lives. Many, especially those born of a forbidden union, were destroyed at birth. That was the world into which the Kiramak was born. It is important you understand this, because the Kiramak should not exist. One of a brood of brown-scale Cyruk, the Kiramak alone possessed color. But it does not just have one color. The Kiramak has all colors. That is what makes it unique among the Cyruk. Lothan performed a complicated gesture, involving the muscles of his tail and spine, as though shrugging his entire body. That the Kiramak was a sport, a deviant birth, was clear. It had no clear gender, and its size was anomalous, but that was irrelevant. Its birth sent shock waves through the Cyruk. They place a great value on spiritual matters, as you know, and such a birth had been prophesied for millennia. The Kiramak, the birth of many colors, would be the one to take the oppressed and make them lords. The Kiramak would make the weak strong. What you're saying, Han said, is that the Sai-Rook embraced the Kiramak because they thought it would lead them to victory over us, right?
That is correct, Rothen said.
They raised it like a king, with every privilege and opportunity to learn and grow. The Kiramak soon proved to be exceptional in all respects, strong, intelligent, wise. It argued with the Shrieftut over the limitations of power. It challenged the Conclave on matters of theology. And it rivaled the Elders' Council when it came to minor points of law. But ultimately, it was the Kiramak's compassion that was its greatest point, as well as the Sai-Rook's undoing.
"It shows you over them?" Leia asked.
"The Kiramak was the one who led us to victory over our former masters. It conceived our revolt and consolidated the aftermath. Within a year, Thwek was ours, and the Sairuvi Imperium a thing of the past. And now, 5 years on, the Kiramak still guides our destiny."
"Impressive," Leia said. Throwing off an oppressor is only the beginning of a long and difficult journey.
Jaina nodded, knowing that her mother spoke from experience. In the wake of our liberation, we have continued research into entechment, Dwathan said through C-3PO. We have found ways to nourish the stored minds reclaimed during our revolution. The life energy distilled from concentrated banks of algae and other primitive life forms can prevent the decay common to previous soul captures. It also goes a long way toward staving off the discomfort many feel when intact. Now that we have diverted much of the life-draining work to your forms of technology and reduced the strain on the intact soul, we have reversed many of the wrongs forced upon captives and slaves in the past. The droid fighters you saw today are piloted by those intact in the last days of the Imperium.
Rothen's triple eyelids blinked in a complicated manner.
Although we do continue to offer entechment as a form of military service, there are few who willingly sacrifice their physical lives. There's no way back, of course. Such a decision is not lightly made.
I'm sure it wouldn't be, Leia said as she faced General Panib.
From the tone of her mother's voice, coupled with the set of her shoulders, and the way she sat in the chair before her, Jaina could tell she wasn't entirely convinced by Lwathan's lengthy explanation, even though it did concur with the odd force readings they'd had from the droid fighters.
"General Panib, have you seen anything to contradict Lwathan's statement that no one has been intact against his or her will?"
"None of us have been intact, if that's what you're getting at," the general said. "In fact, there have been no aggressive moves made against us whatsoever. Although..."
"What?"
Han prompted, leaning forward slightly in his chair.
"Well, that's something else we will need to talk about. Why you've come at such a bad time.
The Pwek arrived here 2 weeks ago, offering a treaty. Prime Minister Kundertal and the Senate deliberated for days before arriving at the decision to accept the offer. The Prime Minister's announcement caused a few riots. It's hard to explain to the general population that we haven't sold them out."
"I can understand that," Han muttered.
"We thought the people were coming around," Panib went on. "The defense advantages of joining with the Pwek are obvious, given the Yuuzhan Vong's gradual drift this way. And we had a lot to be grateful to them for, since they did get rid of the Sairuvi threat."
Panib fidgeted uneasily. "But there are complications and conditions."
"Such as?" Leia asked. "Lwathan has mentioned religion. The Pwek are like the Sairuk, in that they share some of the same traditions. In order to make them comfortable, there are details we have to attend to. Kundertal wanted this Kiramak of theirs to come to Bakara to sign the treaty in person, but it wouldn't come unless Bakara was consecrated. You see, it believes, like the rest of the Sairuk, that if it dies away from one of the sacred worlds, then its soul will be lost forever. And the fact is, assassination isn't out of the question, especially given the volatile temperament of some of the public right now. His glance to Lwathan was filled with apology. We are neighbors. We must learn to trade and fight side by side. If Bakra and the Pwek are to work together, then we have to consider all our religious beliefs. We'd like them to feel safe enough to visit here. Toward this end, Kundertal managed to find a compromise. The Kirimak would come to Bakra to perform the consecration in person. The ceremony was planned for 2 days from now. That's where things stood when Prime Minister Kundertal disappeared, interrupted a voice from the entrance to the chamber. Jaina's grip on her lightsaber tightened instinctively as she turned to see a tall, aging man in a scarlet robe approach the table. His face was long and angular, the bones beneath clearly showing. Two Bakaran guards closely shadowed him, rifles held firmly across their chests. "Deputy Prime Minister Harris," Ponib said, standing. He sounded relieved. "Thank you for joining us." Harris indicated for Ponib to return to his seat, then nodded to everyone else around the table by way of greeting. "Princess Leia, Captain Solo, it's a pleasure to meet you again. And of course you, Lwathan." An attendant brought up a chair, and he sat between the Pwek and Leia. "I apologize for the delay," he said to Ponib, "but there was a bomb threat at the main spaceport, and I had to take a shuttle from Lesser Grace. As you can see," he explained to the rest of the table, "we are suffering from a pronounced civil unrest. Not on behalf of the majority, I imagine, but rather a violent and unprincipled minority who think they know what's best for Bakra. This minority has decided that the Pwek are no different from the Syruk, and the Kirimak's visit here is nothing more than an elaborate ruse that will result in the entechment of everyone. Once an enemy, always an enemy, is their maxim. There is simply no room for negotiation." He clenched his fists helplessly on the table. His gaze fell upon Leia and Han. "I understand you have experienced interference from them already." "A secure transmission was interrupted by someone warning us away," Leia said. "Whoever it was had access to comm channels that should have been restricted." "They are everywhere," Harris said sourly. "As the consecration looms, their desperation increases. They have been behind at least 5 disruptions to subspace communications in the last fortnight. Kidnapping Moliere Kundertal was an act of suicidal bravado. It is strange, but while I have to condemn their methods, I can't help admire their spirit." He shook his head sadly. "Nevertheless, we will never negotiate with terrorists." "What about Kundertal?" Han asked. "Any idea where he's being kept?" "We'll find out soon enough, especially now that we have the terrorist leader in our hands." General Ponib was clearly taken aback by this news. "Since when?" "She was taken into custody shortly before I left to come here. We have her in a security holding cell, awaiting interrogation." "Is she—" Ponib hesitated. "Who we suspected she was?" "Melinza Thanis," Harris answered with a smug smile. "Yes." The surprise in the room was palpable. Jaina knew the name. Melinza Thanis was the daughter of people her parents and Uncle Luke had met on Bakra the first time they'd visited. When Melinza's parents had died, Luke and Mara had taken her on as a sponsor child, visiting her a couple of times. She'd heard nothing about the girl being a terrorist leader, however.
"Melinza?" Leia asked. "Are you certain of this?"
"There's no doubt," Harris stated. "She admits it herself."
"She admits she kidnapped the Prime Minister?" Panab asked.
"Not yet, but it's only a matter of time."
"When you say interrogation—"
"I don't mean to imply torture, Princess," Harris said. "We are a civilized people, and it would take more than a little civil unrest to reduce us to savages."
"This doesn't add up."
Han was shaking his head. "Whoever we spoke to when we arrived warned us away because they thought we were after your ships. They implied that the Prek were your allies. But that contradicts what you've just told us about the terrorists. If they're anti-Prek, they wouldn't want any association with them at all."
"What can I say?
They are confused and directionless. Their aims unclear even to themselves." Harris shrugged dismissively. "We have suffered at the hands of such isolationist groups ever since the overthrow of the Empire. There are indeed those who resent the intrusion of the New Republic into our affairs. Some of these may have allied themselves with the anti-Prek movement to gain the illusion of numbers. Such people won't be happy until Bakara stands alone against the rest of the galaxy, and inevitably falls alone, too."
"So what now?"
Panib asked. "The first thing, General, is to put our house in order. While we look for the Prime Minister, I suggest we end martial law and begin preparations for the consecration. The treaty depends on it. The Prime Minister would not want it delayed for anything. With your permission, I shall convene the Senate and get things moving."
"Of course."
The General's relief was obvious. "There's not much time and a lot to be done."
Rothen spoke up. "We understand that this is a difficult time for you," C-3PO translated, "and we are grateful for your continued efforts to bring our governments together."
The Prek's beak snapped emphatically. "I will convey my assurances to the Kiramak that all is in order, and the ceremony will go ahead as planned."
"Thank you, my friend."
Blaine Harris inclined his head in the direction of the Prek ambassador.
"And you, of course,"
he added to Han and Leia, "are very welcome to attend also. I'm sure it will be a fascinating glimpse into a culture we've theorized about for many years, but never had the opportunity to see with our own eyes."
"We'd be honored," Leia said. "The Galactic Federation of Free Alliances will be very interested to observe the ceremony."
General Panib stood, and the others around the table followed suit. "I hope you won't be offended if I call this meeting to an end, but I have urgent matters to discuss with the Deputy Prime Minister."
"Of course."
Leia accepted the explanation with her usual diplomatic aplomb.
"And thank you for taking the time to explain the situation here. There are still some aspects I'd like to discuss in more detail at a later date, if possible."
"It would be my pleasure to accommodate you," the General said. He spoke and moved with a confidence that had been lacking before the Deputy Prime Minister's news. "And I shall ensure that Salus Dar Spaceport is secured for your arrival. Hopefully, with Thanis in custody, the situation will cool down a little now."
Leia bowed in acknowledgment.
The Deputy Prime Minister bowed also as Leia and Han's party filed toward the exit. Luothan and his two bodyguards followed close behind, and although he made no effort to come too close, Jaina still made sure to position herself carefully between her parents and the powerful Saurian. Once outside, the Prek fluted in his loud, melodic way. "Luothan says that this is a pivotal time for all our species. C-3PO interpreted. More fluting and gesturing followed. He also says that he is glad that you will be attending the ceremony. The Kirimak will be pleased when it hears the news. Without waiting for a response, the Puek headed off down the corridor, bodyguards in tow.
"Chirpy fellow, ain't he?" Han said.
"Something's not adding up here," Jaina said. She was glad the meeting was over, and she was once again able to be involved in discussions.
"How can the Bakaran resistance be everywhere and yet still be a minority?"
"Maximum disruption," Leia said, "for minimum effort. We could be seeing the Peace Brigade at work here."
"What's left of them," Han muttered.
"It's like getting a dent out of a deflector grill, even after Elysia."
"At least we're not too late this time," Jaina said, the destruction of Nazoth still fresh in her mind.
"That's assuming, of course," Leia said, "that we have the full story."
"The story, Yusha. Tell us the story," whispered the acolytes, crowding the darkened audience hall. "Tell us about the Jedi."
The prophet gazed down at them from his throne, his expression hidden behind a mask of truly horrific proportions. A maze of scars and tattoos, it was barely recognizable as a face.
"Who asks?"
he demanded in accordance with the service.
"We do, Yusha."
The pilgrims responded with a unified bowing of their heads.
"We are the shamed ones, and we come to you for wisdom."
The prophet nodded, satisfied by the formal response. Warders outside the hall had carefully instructed the audience on how and when to speak. The being on the inside of the mask smiled to himself, knowing that these conventions were nothing more than a sham to encourage obedience to him and, ultimately, rebellion against his enemies. Numanor rose from his seat on the throne and removed the mask. The hideous creation was meant to represent Shimra and the gods, while its removal symbolized the casting off of the old ways. He had devised every detail of the ceremony with the help of Shun Mai and Kunra, his chief acolytes. But no matter how many times he did it, it still felt clumsy. Only the reactions of the converts convinced him that it was working. The acolytes looked wonderingly up at Nomanor's real face, not aware that this was just another mask, an Uglith masker designed to make him look like a member of the shamed caste.
"The gods have granted me a vision," he announced. "It is a vision of a galaxy of beautiful worlds, worlds in which all Yuuzhan Vong can live in peace as well as in glory, free of shame, and with everything their hearts and souls desire."
In recent weeks, Numanor had learned to become more animated and expressive when addressing the groups that came to hear him speak. At first he had just sat there and spoken, but he soon found the attention of the shamed ones would drift beneath his dull monotones. So he'd adopted some of the techniques he had observed in Vurok Ipan, a storyteller from the group of shamed ones that had first taken him in during his initial exile to Yuuzhan Tar's underworld. Numanor clearly recalled how Ipan had told the story of Vuorapung, and how those gathered had listened intently, hanging from his every word, even though they had heard the tale so many times before. "But as I gazed upon this vision," Numanor went on with dramatic flair, "a dark shadow came between my hungry eyes and the sight of the worlds that should be ours. The huge black shadow had rainbows that shined from its eyes. Its mighty hands were darkened from bloodstains." The congregation listened spellbound, just as Ipan's audience had once listened to him. Numanor raised a hand to demand silence, an unnecessary gesture since the silence was already profound, but one that served to reinforce his command over the gathering. "The gods opposed the great shadow, the rainbow-eyed one, and they brought forth their holy warriors to strike it down." He stared down at the crowd. "You know the name of these warriors." The whisper surrounded him. "Jedi." He nodded his approval and leaned forward as though to impart a great secret. And it was a great secret, for uttering it could easily mean the death of everyone in the room. "Yes. The gods sent the Jedi to drive away the rainbow-eyed enemy. For weeks and months they fought. The shadow killed many of the holy warriors and kept the rest at bay. Night fell across the galaxy, and it seemed as though the war was hopelessly lost. Our home had been taken from us. The Yuuzhan Vong were no longer favored by the gods, for we had debased ourselves on the altar of the shadow."
"No,"
moaned one in the congregation, shaking his head. Even from his place at the front of the congregation, Nomanor could smell the rank odor of the shamed one's decaying arm. He smiled inwardly. It was all too easy to work his will over the loose-knit congregations of heretics that infested the capital. Their members were weak and desperate, while he was strong and resourceful. "No, indeed," he said. "Even as despair overcame me at the defeat of the Jedi, even as it seemed as though the rainbow-eyed one would never be stopped, the gods gave me hope. For just when all was dark, I saw the grasses of the field turn against the shadow. I saw them rise and wrap around the feet of the rainbow-eyed one. The enemy stumbled and fell, and then the grasses rose to bind the shadow's mighty limbs. The grasses held this foe of the gods to the ground, wrapping themselves around his throat and squeezing the very life from him, removing the influence of his black heart from the land. By themselves, each blade of grass was weak, but together they were mighty." The congregation sighed with relief and joy at the exclamation. "Let us be as the grass, and twine about the feet of our adversary to bring him crashing down. For individually we may be weak, but like the grass, together we can be strong." The congregation hissed its appreciation, and Nomanor basked in their approval. In all the years he'd served as an executor, he had never had such an audience. It had been impossible to speak honestly or openly for fear of offending the War Master or the priests, or, through them, the gods. Now he had the attention of hundreds, and they would listen to anything he said. He was wise enough to realize, though, that such attention would last only as long as they approved of his message. They devoured the nonsense about the Jedi, along with his message of self-empowerment, and while he had no great belief in the former, he was very much in favor of the latter. The shamed ones were his ride back to the surface. He was happy to give them the means so he could achieve the end. The allure of the means wasn't lost on him. As an executor, he hadn't properly appreciated the need and strength of the lower castes. The shamed ones were indeed weak individually, as he taught in his sermons. But this was easily made up for with their overwhelming numbers. The majority had belonged to the worker caste before their shaming, but some had been of higher rank. Moreover, it wasn't just the shamed ones who answered his call. Converts to his Jedi cult were increasingly drawn from junior members of the unshamed, from the workers, the shapers, the warriors, the priests, and the intendants. The shapers knew the tools of their trade. The priests and intendants knew how to organize, and the warriors knew how to fight. Anyone who descended upon one of these meetings to make arrests was in for a nasty surprise. Although it was hard to remember sometimes, those in his audience weren't particularly gullible. They weren't uneducated. They weren't stupid. They just wanted authority, and he would give it to them. When the muttering died away, he returned to the throne and motioned the audience to gather around him. In reality, the chamber was just a large basement hundreds of meters below the spires of Yuuzhan'tar, and his throne, was just a chair coated in moss of different shades to make it look better than it really was. It didn't matter. The congregation saw what it wanted to see, just as it heard what it wanted to hear. Numanor leaned forward to talk to them, with less ceremony. It was time to give them the message. "How many here have met the Jedi, face to face?" he asked. "How many have heard the message from their own lips, in their own tongue?" He waited for someone to answer in the affirmative, but, as always, no one did. In all the sermons he'd given, not one of the shamed ones who came to him had ever met or even seen a single example of the ones they venerated and looked to for liberation. "I have met the Jedi," he said. "I have gazed upon the twins and seen their power. I have wondered at the Jedi who was shaped. I witnessed the death of perhaps the greatest of them all, the one called Anakin Solo, who gave his life so that the ones he loved might live. And I have spoken to their elders and heard their message with my own ears. That I have done all these things and am here before you now attests to the truth of what I have told you. If what I say is not the truth, then may the gods strike me down here and now where I stand, and erase this blasphemy from the heart of the galaxy." Numanor could feel the congregation holding its collective breath, and he hid another a smile as he dragged out the pause a little longer than was strictly necessary. He wanted the acolytes to realize that they were still afraid of the old gods, that old habits died hard. He never grew tired of seeing the impact his words had upon the shamed ones. It never failed to amuse him how he could manipulate their emotions. Strictly speaking, Numanor's claims weren't lies. He had met a lot of Jedi in the course of his duty, just not in the capacity of an ally. Nor had he ever stopped to listen to their philosophy. They'd usually been on the receiving end of one of his schemes to betray and destroy them, or he'd been doing his level best to survive when those schemes went wrong. When the silence was as taut as a stretched ligament, he began to tell them the story of Vuorapung, the shamed one who had found redemption in the actions of the Jedi Knight called Anakin Solo. They had all heard it before, of course. None of them would have made it this far had they not been able to give at least a rough outline of the story, thereby demonstrating that someone thought them trustworthy. But this was the official version, as taught by the prophet. It contained all the correct details in the right order, and was consistent with the known facts. It conveyed precisely the right message at exactly the right time. So Numanor intended it, anyway. Again, lacking true belief, he could only judge by the reactions of those who came to hear him speak. They listened rapturously and left enlivened, empowered to spread the message. All knew that being associated in any way with the prophet would mean torture and death. The keepers of the old gods were jealous and did not tolerate challengers to their beliefs. How far knowledge of the existence of the cult had spread was hard to say. Did Shimra lose concentration during his nightly flagellations as he pondered the spreading rot? Numanor could only hope so. And there the Jedi heresy might have ended, had it not been witnessed by the shamed ones watching from the edge of the battle, by the Shaper's Damutek. They spread the message, and to this day the message continues to spread from mouth to ear among those like us. There is another way, a way that leads to acceptance, and a new word for hope. Jedi. Numanor paused at the end of the tale to sip from a drink bulb that Shun Mai had ensured was at hand before the acolytes had filed into the room. The ending of the tale was identical to the ending he had first heard from Ipan. He told it this way to remind himself both of the story's origins and of Ipan's fate. Ipan's death at the hands of a band of warriors that had come searching for stolen provisions, thefts Ipan had conducted with Numanor in order to keep their small band of outlaws alive, had galvanized Numenor into action. Without that to motivate him, he might have still been living in anonymity, waiting for his luck to run out instead of making his own. "I shall answer your questions now," he said after a moment. There were always questions. "Did Yun Yuzhan create the Jedi?" was the first, shouted by a female near the front. "Yun Yuzhan created all things," he answered, "the Jedi included. They are as much a part of his plan as we are. This will probably seem confusing to some, but you must remember that we should never assume to know Yun Yuzhan's plan in its entirety. We are as gazakal worms before him. Would such a worm understand even the most menial task you perform?"
"Are they aspects of Yun Shuno, then?" a male cried out from the back.
"As with all beings, different ones appeal to different gods. The twin Jedi, Jaina and Jason Solo, are often associated with the twin gods Yun Shin and Yun Ka. Jaina is also associated with Yun Harla, the trickster. All the Jedi are disciplined warriors, so they fight with the favor of Yun Yamka, the slayer. They revere life as does Yun Neshel, the modeler. Self-sacrifice for the greater good is part of their teaching, as it is with Yun Yuzhan. And yes, they have acted as intercessors for the shamed ones in the fashion of Yun Shuno. But in essence, they are beings like us. They are not themselves gods any more than Shimra is. They are mortal. They can be killed. I know this because I have seen them die with my own eyes. There are even stories of Jedi who wreak destruction instead of good, so we know that they have flaws like us. It is their teaching we must follow, so we can be strong like them, so we can be accepted as equals again.
Yusha, what is the Force?"
Numenor pretended to ponder this question before he answered. In reality, he had already given it a great deal of thought. He had seen firsthand the effects of the Force, but he had never understood it. Unlike those he had once served, however, he refused to dismiss that failure to understand as a failure on behalf of the Jedi. That was absurd. He simply could not hide from the fact that the Jedi Knights had access to something that the Yuuzhan Vong clearly did not. It became worse the more he thought about it. If, as the Jedi claimed, the Yuuzhan Vong truly didn't possess the mystical life force or energy field that filled, or fueled, the galaxy they had invaded, did that mean, then, that the Yuuzhan Vong and all their works, and their gods, were as empty and lifeless as the machines they despised? There were two obvious solutions to this problem, as far as Numenor could see. One was to embrace the teachings of the Jedi in order to learn more about what had gone wrong, and maybe save themselves from a pointless non-life. The other was to find evidence, somehow, that the Yuuzhan Vong weren't entirely closed to this ubiquitous force, that somewhere inside them existed the same spark of life that burned in the Jedi. His answer to the question attempted to address both solutions in a way that left neither resolved. "The Force is an aspect of creation, the same as matter and energy. It may even be an aspect of the creation, the primordial sacrifice that brought forth all things from Yun Yuzhan. We are taught that Yun Yuzhan is the source of all life, the overlord who, through great pain to himself, created the lesser gods and thus, by connection, the Yuuzhan Vong. We assume that his sacrifice was of his body, as his followers might sacrifice an arm or 1,000 captives in his honor. But why should that be so? Why do we limit Yun Yuzhan's generosity only to that which we can see and touch? Just as the wind is invisible to our eyes, there are many more things in the universe than we can sense with our corporeal bodies, and all these things spring ultimately from Yun Yuzhan. The Force is part of that, too."
"But what is it exactly?" Numenor shook his head.
I cannot address that question, my friends, because I simply do not have the answer. On this matter, I am as ignorant as all of you. The Force is a mystery, one that may haunt us forever. All we can do is grope in the darkness for that thing we know is missing, in the hope that we might somehow stumble across it by chance.
Numenor leaned forward again, dropping his voice to a whisper, so they were forced to listen closely to his words.
So far in my groping, I have discovered two things that I want you to consider. The first is that our way and the way of the Jedi are not necessarily at odds with each other. I'm not suggesting, as some have proposed, that we replace our pantheon with that of the Jedi and the Force, but that we are both prophets of a new way.
He paused again, but not long enough for anyone to voice another question. The other thing is no more than speculation, really, but I offer it to you anyway, for you to consider. I mentioned before that Yun Yuzhan's sacrifice might have been of more than just his body, that he might have offered up things in order to bring the universe into being, things that the likes of you and I can neither see nor sense. We see aspects of him reflected in everything around us. So is it not possible that the Force, in all its mystery and wonder, is what remains of Yun Yuzhan's soul?
Numenor leaned back into the throne, leaving them to ponder that thought for a moment. He honestly didn't know if it meant anything or not, but the audience seemed to think it profound. He let himself relax while they contemplated the notion. These were the toughest questions, and he was glad to get them out of the way early, but they were also the ones he had prepared for the most. From here on, if the acolytes followed the usual patterns, the questions would be relatively trivial.
"Who are you, Yusha?"
asked a disfigured warrior from off to one side of the gathering. He dodged the answer with rhetoric, in much the same way he might have once deflected thudbugs with his amphistaff.
"I am one of you, anonymous in servitude, remarkable only for my willingness to speak out against those who would have us defiled."
"Where did you come from?"
"Like you, like all of you, I was born and raised on one of the many world ships that crossed the gulfs between galaxies, following our ancestors' vision of a promised land."
It was the truth, of course, just not the whole truth.
Numenor had acted as an advance scout, arriving many years before the main body of the migration. His mission had been to gather information about the governments and species occupying the worlds ahead. He had prepared the way for later agents, exploring pressure points and sowing seeds of dissent. Those seeds had flowered into rebellions and counter-rebellions, destabilizing the New Republic and widening the cracks that had ultimately led to its downfall. During the war, he had helped found the Peace Brigade that had so jeopardized the Jedi cause, and set many other schemes into motion. But there was no way he was going to let them know that.
"Is the war wrong?" asked one from the front, his eyes wide and hungry for answers.
That was a difficult question. Being pro-Jedi didn't necessarily mean that the galaxy wasn't intended to be the Yuuzhan Vong's new home. It didn't mean that it was wrong to fight the Galactic Alliance, since it wasn't ruled by Jedi and didn't openly advocate Jedi values. It was perfectly reasonable to be soundly pro-Jedi, and yet at the same time fanatically opposed to any suggestion that the war should be ended. The trouble was, Numenor suspected that the Yuuzhan Vong were now losing the war. He had no confidence in Shimra's ability to restore the situation. He understood the bankruptcy of the Supreme Overlord's regime. He knew of the lies, the betrayals, the desperate search for an antidote in the form of the Eighth Cortex. Without a radical change in direction or fortune, the Galactic Alliance was going to win. For the worshippers of Yun Yamka, the god of carnage, there was no such thing as losing. There was only winning or dying. A failure to defeat the Galactic Alliance would inevitably mean a fight to the end, and the destruction of all that Numenor held dear.
His only hope, therefore, was to change the direction of the war from beneath, by muddying the waters for the enemy. Would the Jedi be so keen to attack when they had supporters in the Yuuzhan Vong ranks? He suspected not. They were warriors, but they were also guilty of compassion. "The war is an aberration," he said, offering the reply he always used when fielding this kind of question. "It is a lie. We should never have been fighting the Jedi in the first place, since they are the only ones who will speak up for those without voices, those like us. Nor should we be fighting those who call the Jedi allies, either, since alone the Jedi are insufficient to destroy the Supreme Overlord. We should be fighting the ones who pit like against like, who use fear and betrayal to keep the powerless in their place, who would strike down Yun Yuuzhan himself in order to satisfy their greed. It is never wrong to fight for what is ours, but you must make certain that you do so for the right reasons. Be clear who your enemy is. It is shame. But together, like the grass, we can bring an end to this shame once and for all." The audience responded enthusiastically to his words, and this time Nomanor did smile. They were his now, would do anything for him. He had led them to the noose, and they had happily put their heads through of their own accord. "What do we do now, Prophet?" Nomanor sought out the questioner and recognized him as the one with the severely decayed arm. The acolyte's eye sacs were a deep, intense blue, almost visibly pulsing with blood. His stare was the kind Nomanor had seen many times before, before and since he had formed the cult. For some, belief was so much more than just a guide to living. It became life itself. That was understandable, he thought, when they had so little else to live for. "You are among the first to receive the message," he said, addressing the whole room. "Your duty now is to spread it to others so that they, too, will come to understand it. Some of these may choose to come here and receive further instruction, themselves to become messengers. The message will spread like a flood, washing our shame away." A murmur of approval rolled around the gathering, punctuated by the nodding of many heads. "There will, of course, be those who will hear the message but do nothing with it," Nomanor went on. "They will keep it in their hearts, secrete it away from others as though it were some rare spore they have found. For these individuals I feel nothing but pity. The message can only be of value if it is heard. For that, and that alone, is its purpose. Remaining silent after you hear the message is akin to giving approval of the way you have been treated, of being complicit with the enemy." He let the sentence trail off, then sighed. The time had come to end the audience. He had said everything he needed to say. "My friends, I fear for all of you. Although we have right on our side, we are still fledglings who must confront hostility at every corner. Should word of our existence and identities ever reach the higher ranks, then every one of us involved will be hunted down and killed. Therefore, I ask you all to take every precaution as you spread the message and recruit for our cause. A whisper will spread, but a shout would most surely be silenced. With patience and perseverance, we will prevail. I ask you to go now in the strength and knowledge that the spirit of freedom is with us." Nomanor stood and opened his arms, as though to embrace them all. At the signal, the doors at the back of the cellar opened, allowing the newly recruited acolytes to file out. He smiled beneficently as they left, radiating goodwill and trust. It was very different from how he had once dealt with underlings. There was a time when he would have sent them off with curses and threats, trusting in fear to keep them loyal. But this wouldn't work on the shamed ones. Threatening them with punishment would only demonstrate that he was no different from the rest of their masters. If he had learned one thing from his disguise, it was that when fear was a way of life and there was nothing left to lose, The only incentive remaining was reward. When they were gone, he collapsed back into the throne. "Go now, in the knowledge that you are the instruments of my authority, and the means by which I shall attain the glory I deserve. A good audience, Yusha?" He looked up. The shamed warrior Kumra, who acted as his bodyguard and occasional conscience, had entered the room, closely followed by Numanor's truest believer, Shunmai Esh. Shunmai wore the robes of a priest, though without the insignia of any of the Yuuzhan'vong deities. Kumra wore no armor, belying the cowardice that had caused his fall from grace. Knowing their true selves, Numanor thought them a pathetic entourage for any would-be revolutionary. But he had to admit that the converts responded well to them. "Nothing special," he said in his usual rough voice. There was no need to soliloquize with these two. "What we are gaining in quantity, we are losing in quality. A couple of them looked like they were about to die on their feet."
"I apologize, master."
Shunmai made fawning motions with his gnarled hands. "I did not feel it my place to turn anyone with need aside." "Soon you will have to, Shunmai." Beneath his tiredness and irritation, Numanor felt an abiding satisfaction at the way the movement was growing. Every day brought more penitents to their door, seeking the truth of the message spreading around Yuuzhan'tar. "Perhaps it is time to start training the select. You have the list?" Shunmai nodded vigorously, eager to please. "I have identified 17 who qualify. Loyal without being blind," Numanor said, going over the prerequisites for those chosen. "Quick thinkers, but not too intelligent, yes?"
"Yes, master.
Then call them to me." He glanced around at his surroundings. "The sooner the better, for I grow weary of the stench down here." Shunmai inclined his head.
"They will stand before you tomorrow, master," he said, making to leave.
Before he had gone 5 steps, Numanor stopped him. "Shunmai," he called. The shamed one turned to face him. "I could not have done this without you. I want you to know that." The highest of Numanor's acolytes beamed with pride as he scurried off to do his duty. The self-styled prophet buried a flash of irritation. Although part of him wished he had killed the fool when he'd had the chance, he had to acknowledge Shunmai's usefulness. He was dedicated and resourceful, and Numanor felt he owed it to Shunmai's sister, Nirit, one of the first true believers of the message, not to kill him. Kunra would be sure to remind him if he tried, he was sure. That wasn't the most irritating thing, though. Shunmai's willingness to work for nothing but praise stuck in Numanor's throat like a bone. The ex-warrior stood in silence by the door, watching him. Numanor had come to know Kumra well enough to realize when he had something on his mind.
"What is it?"
"You'd better see for yourself." Kumra turned and walked through the hall's main entrance and into the antechamber. From there, he led Numanor along a short corridor to the small cell in which Kumra slept. There, immobilized by blorash jelly, lay a female dressed in rags. Her cheek was heavily bruised, but her eyes were open and filled with defiance. She was carrying this, Kunra said, offering Numanor the remains of a small, larva-like creature. Its leathery shell had been crushed and would have been barely recognizable had not Numanor seen such things many times before. It was a villip. The female had obviously intended to bring it into the meeting so that the person on the other end could watch the prophet in action. That in itself was not necessarily sinister. Some of the acolytes had attempted to spread the message via villips before, or so they had claimed. Numanor knew, however, that he couldn't afford to take the chance. "Does Shunmai know?" he asked, keeping his stare fixed on the female.
"No. I make sure to check all acolytes before they reach him. This one came alone and was out of the way before he had a chance to suspect anything."
Numanor nodded his approval. It made things much simpler.
I want the name of the person holding her master, Villip," he said coldly. "Find out how much she knows about us while you're at it. Get the information any way you have to. Then kill her." Kunra didn't argue. "I understand." The female started to struggle, her protests muffled by the gag in her mouth. Numanor ignored her. "I shall explain to Shunmai that we have to relocate again." "He won't like it." He faced Kunra. "I'm sure he'd prefer it to dying." Without a further glance at the prisoner, he turned and walked away.